All right. Good afternoon. This is a meeting of the Colorado Voter Access and Modernized Elections Commission. The date is September 16, 2013. The time is approximately 1:10. We're meeting in the Aspen Room of the Secretary of State's office, 1700 Broadway on the third floor. It looks like everybody is present for the meeting today. Clerk Hall will be calling in about 10 minutes from now. She's running a little bit late. The first item on the agenda are public comments, and the first person I have signed up is Harvey Branscombe.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm Harvey Branscombe from Eagle County, Carbondale, Colorado, Western Slope. First, I want to just list 8 questions I'd like to present to the commission. And I'm not going to explain them, just tell them so they get on the record, and I'll send them by email later. Number one, I'm interested in knowing the source counties of the interesting surveys that SLI Systems put out to the counties, partly verbally, partly written surveys. Secondly, I'm wondering why we should consider the obsolescence of XP and Windows 2000 operating systems to potentially trigger replacement of voting systems equipment, since they have been functioning with those operating systems just fine, and there's no reason to expect there would be any new bugs discovered since we're not adding new software to those systems. Third is a public policy question about the risks and benefits of DRE plus VVPAT versus the alternatives. This comes to mind because of my work on the public participation panel for the Secretary of State vis-a-vis the Uniform Voting System project. And the fourth is the same question with relationship to ballot on demand. What are the risks and benefits of ballot on demand? Fifth, SLI Systems put a list of voting systems into the public record in its report, but it's not clear what was the basis for selection of those particular, I'm talking about the new voting systems, what was the basis for selecting those particular systems for listing in the report? Sixth, I'm wondering whether this commission will influence the voter verifiability of any one of these 4 principles of voting: anonymity of the ballot, the correct interpretation of what's on the ballot, the countedness of the ballot, and the privacy of the environment for voting the ballot. Seventh, I'm wondering if COVAMEC will, this commission will influence the schedule of the acquisition of voting systems or the uniformity thereof. So I believe that is a schedule that's been set. There's a schedule that's been set by the Secretary of State, but I believe it's a public policy issue. The date that has been set, the dates that have been set, are an issue of public interest. And finally, and most importantly, will this commission help us to understand how our elections are done? So this is what I want to actually focus on for a moment. It's my primary ask to the commission is to understand the details of our election, particularly an election that's been affected by the 1303 bill. The 1303 bill brings us centralization and efficiency, but it also allows better instrumentation of our elections by virtue of that centralization, and it allows and actually asks for more oversight because of the centralization. Compared to the precinct polling place model where we have citizens actually running the election, the central counting of ballots at the county level actually asks for more opportunities and more technology devoted to assisting, or procedures, not technology, not meaning just equipment, but procedures to assist the public in recognizing the accuracy and other qualities in the election. So the counterarguments I'm probably going to hear seems like the principal method for doing this is not actually equipment into the field, but surveys, or a survey to the counties to find out what they're actually doing in detail. And I am going to propose to this commission a list. I have already proposed a list of questions that could be asked about the 2011-2012 elections, which were 2 different kinds of elections. And I wish we had the answers to all those questions. We got some from SLI Systems. But we absolutely need to understand what happened as a result of 1303 in the 2013 election. And so a series of questions similar to the ones that I presented are ones that I believe should be asked. And it's critical that the counties understand what those questions are before they actually finish running the election, so they can answer the questions as they go along, as they have the information in front of them. Now, there's an EAC survey that's being drafted for the 2014 election, And today is the final day for public comments on that, and I just commented on it, and it's quite a good survey, and it covers quite a few areas we'd like to know about. And I propose to start with that survey. It's intended for 2014, but we can ask it in the 2013 election, and we can supplement that survey with other questions that you'd like to know to understand what the 1303 bill actually did, how it had an effect on the counties, the way they run the elections. I'd like to briefly mention the voting systems report. I wrote about it a week ago, thinking there might be a meeting a week ago, and that's in your packet. Mr. Kollwitz wrote about it. He has some very excellent points, many of which I did not cover. One of them, the proposition that there really haven't been problems uncovered in Colorado elections, really isn't true. Now, it is true that the other states, Ohio and California, have done extensive studies of voting systems, and they found problems. Colorado hasn't done equivalent kinds of studies of voting systems, but it has uncovered problems, and I personally know about problems that were uncovered in counties. And so I believe that the reports actually whitewashed that by not actually admitting to a number of problems that have occurred. In fact, probably many we don't know about that were all worked around and solutions found, immediate solutions found, but not the kind of solution you want to have in a future voting system or a new voting method provided by a new bill. So I hope that there's four items of mine about the survey report, the system voting systems report I'd like to mention. One is about the survey anonymity. It's my first question. Why can't we know what counties answered which questions which way? And because of the way the questions have been answered, we understand there's a lot of non-uniformity in Colorado about election practices, even if the equipment's the same. I think this commission would be interested in providing more uniformity among different counties. And in fact, I believe the 1303 bill basically promised us not just mail ballots, but also a real in-person voting with a gold standard of quality. And I believe that includes those four principles I mentioned: anonymity, ability to know the interpretation of the ballot, privacy, countedness of the ballot. Those are things I think our in-person voters would like to achieve. And I hope this commission will help them to get there. And finally, the operating system obsolescence. I think it's a non-issue, actually, and I hope it's not going to be used as an excuse for rushing the uniform voting system or the replacement of voting systems. So finally, if I can have another minute, is that okay? The recall elections have occurred, and this seems to be the elephant in the room today. We need to understand what the real costs are of those elections. We had an unusual opportunity to kind of go back in time and see an election where there was a higher percentage of voters voting in person in a precinct polling place model. And because of that, we can learn again, we can actually compare the cost of a precinct polling place model to mail more accurately and actually from a real election in Colorado that's just recently held. And so I propose that the commission actually survey those two clerks to find out about that election, in addition to what will happen in the 2013 November election. I think we ought to know what the watchers actually saw. I've heard reports. I don't think you have. I think you might want to ask about what was actually seen down in the two counties. I think they operated quite differently. And finally, on the question of whether the 1303 bill should go on hold, there is a Gazette editorial to effect this morning. And I'm generally inclined, and my general ask here is to slow down. I asked the supporters of the 1303 bill to slow down and to look more carefully, and I was actually refused access to the bill along with the Secretary of State and many others. But in general, we need not to rush into new voting systems before we understand what the effects will be. And that's a very good reason for doing something about the effect of the 1303 bill. I am concerned about the fact that we're already basically in the middle of the preparation for an election. So I think it's actually, it kind of violates my principle of being patient and careful to suddenly switch course, as happened in the recall elections, actually, because of court cases. And so I'm concerned about that, but I hope you will seriously consider the benefits that could arise from delaying the implementation of the 1303 bill obviously through, it would require legislation, and that's not an easy thing to achieve at the moment. And that's, those are my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We also received some written comments, and I know, Harvey, we have some of yours. We'll post those online, along with Al Kolwitz, Mary Eberle, and then is Ms. Marks on the phone?
She indicated that she may call in after the comments conclude, so there's about a five-second delay. She, if we could give her a minute, she may decide to call in, but to my knowledge, she's not on the phone currently.
Okay. All right, well, the next item on the agenda is going to be the business practices subgroup briefing document. Is Clerk Hall on the phone yet? No one's on the phone?
I know that we have at least one caller on the phone with us. Who's on the phone?
All right, well, we'll just post the comments from Ms. Marks then, and since Clerk Hall isn't here or on the phone yet, maybe we should skip to the score update. Commission, want to skip ahead and wait for Clerk Hall? Okay. We have Trent Parker. So this was a this is the update sheet that came from the first report that the commission issued. And Representative Rankin had asked us to put a tracking sheet together that would show what kind of updates needed to be done. And so we've done that. And then Trent from our office, from the Secretary's office, is here to give us an update on some of those issues.
Can everyone hear me? Do I have to bend over or it's okay?
I'm Trent Parker. I am the SCORE Technical Manager. I work for the Secretary of State, and I manage the SCORE development. I'm here to just go through the needs assessment as they relate to SCORE development. You have it, yeah. So it actually needs to be updated from the handout that I just went through, but let me go line by line on the ones that are related to us. I'm not really a good public speaker. I used to do it a lot. So,
we don't, I don't know that we need you to, I mean, line by line, how many items do we have? Aren't there?
Well, 16? I'm going through about 10.
Oh, you're going through 10.
It's
okay.
Going to take less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
So the first one, the description is pretty brief, but it pretty much is the first big item in the list for VSPCs. And the VSPC model, this is about the need for more back-end support for VSPCs and the usage. So the usage amount is, right now we have 1,000 Citrix licenses. This is the whole Citrix web requirement. Right now, we're drafting RFIs to request information on existing solutions that might support a VSPC model, and namely ePollBook solutions that are out there. So we're going to use that, and along with the business processes subgroup, all the uniform business processes, we're going to take that, responses to RFI, and all of the 2013 statistics and issues and updates to the processes. We'll also go through that with determining the actual needs of what the new VSPC system to support the model would be like. And the next steps on that would be to develop RFPs to purchase additional software, third-party ePollBooks, things that we can bolt onto the existing system. And we would also develop interfaces that any of those third-party systems would need to the back-end SCORE database. We'll also, parallelly, we've been looking at a prototype we developed last year. The prototype was for combining the early voting module in SCORE. Early voting in SCORE is for processing in-person ballots. They're using that for the 2013 election. So we'll also be looking at doing that side-by-side with a third-party poll book, possibly. Next items are 5, 6, and 7 all together. This is about the request for email communication. Right now we're developing for the Q4 release so that counties will have it available in 2014. The tracking of that, all the forms were changed. Online voter registration is currently being developed to capture that information, and SCORE is being developed to capture that information. Right now counties are using the existing custom field functionality, and we're tracking it as an email option. Going forward, we're developing it right now to automatically capture that from the online registration system, and so that we can use it for tracking communication. Number 8 is tracking email correspondences. So the update on that one would be we're currently developing that separately from capturing the voter's response. So, yes.
Representative Rankin, could I interrupt you just a minute? What I'm really looking at here is anything that says 2013 and has a no by it.
Okay.
Could you just, anytime there's a 2013 and a no, like on item 4.1, I believe,
yeah,
can you just comment on whether we have a risk getting that ready for the 2013 election?
Right. A lot of those I won't be able to speak to those. This one is a no in a 2013 for 4.1, and it was a county business process need. My understanding was that I was here to talk about the SCORE development needs for the 2013 election.
If it's required for 2013, mm-hmm. and are you saying that you're waiting for the county business process to be resolved so that this can be implemented for 2013? What does that mean when there's a no there?
Well, I'm not sure he knows because Trent only does the SCORE side of it, so the voter registration database. If there are other issues like online voter registration, other things that other interactions the counties are having with the secretary's office, we might be able to ask Trevor, but I don't think Trent knows. He's the subject matter expert only on SCORE.
But are you saying there's no software change required to implement the new process? Is that?
Oh.
I'm saying
maybe
that
Trevor?
I don't know.
Trevor, does the no mean we don't need to do it or we're not going to get it done? I think that's the question.
Exactly.
So they're going from there. Again, Trevor Timmons, CIO, Secretary of State's office. So it's a mix, actually. We will not achieve some things that are required for the 2014 election. Things for the 2013 election are either changes in county business process. That 4.1 is specific to counties sending confirmation cards. We can, outside of SCORE, produce extracts. Many counties actually produce data files that they will then process outside of SCORE to produce confirmation cards. It's not a core function that SCORE has to handle, you know, as part of its core system functions, but it is something that counties, yes, to comply with 1303 in 2013, they will have to generate those confirmation cards. They're not required to, and many counties choose not to use SCORE to actually provide that function. They may work independently and perform those.
And I think item 5, that's clearly stated that we don't need modification. So. Okay.
Go ahead.
Cindy Acree. On this report, where it does indicate no under completed, if it's a requirement of the counties, do we have any way of knowing whether or not the counties will be able to complete that on time in any of those categories?
Again, Trevor Timmons. I believe that counties, you know, through the auspices of the business practices subgroup, I believe that they are actively working on those areas where for the 2013 elections, the odd year coordinated election, that they are going to be able to comply with those needs. Now, some of the areas where you'll see that a county business process is the appropriate, you know, means to actually comply with legislation, some of the steps that counties will take this year don't require software changes. That doesn't mean that based on findings this year that we wouldn't seek to make improvements to SCORE, to actually have the system actually handle some of those functions automatically rather than require, you know, humans in vote center and polling centers to actually apply their knowledge, you know, to handle a specific scenario.
Go ahead.
I guess my question is really, how are we going to gauge where we are in this process if we don't have feedback from the counties on areas where it's listed not completed, but we would like to know where they are in the process?
Go ahead.
This is Elena Nunez. We do have an agenda item for the business practice subgroup to update us, and maybe we could just make that a regular part of the agenda, since I know a lot of these issues are things that are being worked through, and they can tell us if it's part of a standard process or something that counties are doing in a, you know, more individualized basis, and maybe that's a way to address some of these issues, because I think it's not so much that it's not complete, we just don't necessarily know what it is.
This is Fran Long, and on that specific one that you're talking about, 4.1, if you'll look over to the next column, it says see items 30 to 41. And if you look at those items, it kind of says the same thing that Trevor just told us here, that it really deals with the NCOA and address changes or anything like that. And we've been doing that for a long time, the confirmation card, so it's already built in, and our processes are built for that. There are a couple of processes that we're changing. We've worked on that, and with the help of other counties' input, we've really been able to address those needs.
Cindy agreed. Then why would this column not say completed if you already have addressed them? I guess my concern is I don't have any logical way of gauging the status on where we are in complying with these requirements.
Agreed. This analysis was first put out with the first assessment, and I don't think that anything has been changed in it yet. And so I agree that we need a update on it so that we know where we're at.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And again, Trevor Timmons, Secretary of State's office, I can commit to actually updating that. As Clerk Long pointed out, the initial version of this, the 61 items, did come out of the July 1st report. Mr. Parker is actually addressing the core software development needs that we understand are necessary for 2014 and going forward, and he can address those in detail to the commission. And then we can take the 61 items, the original spreadsheet, back and identify those areas where we believe that work, whether through rulemaking, whether through county business process analysis, or whether through software development, that we've actually met those for the 2013 election, and then, of course, looking forward as well.
So for the rest of this stuff today, going through this presentation, would you be careful to point out any software-related issues where we have not yet completed them that are needed for 2013, if there are any?
Yeah. Hi, Trent Parker again. The answer is there are none. All the software development needs for 2013 have been addressed. And so those are the ones I'm going to highlight. And then additionally, the other needs for 2013, 2014, I'll be talking about those briefly. So we left off at 4.1, right? Go back to my notes. And then I spoke about 5, 6, and 7, about the receiving email communication. We're currently in development for number 8. This is a 2014 need for the software development. The 2013 need was addressed with the custom fields, current functionality, which is not the 100% correct way to do it. So we're developing it for 2014, the correct way to do 5, 6, and 7, as well as 8. My next update is on 10, 11, 12, and 13. This is regards to the registration deadlines. Currently, the 2013 need is under number 17. I apologize for jumping around too much, but these five items are all related in that they came out to be one software development need under number 17 to update the messaging on the OLVR online registration system. So number 17 is currently in development and being analyzed, and will be released before the 8-day deadline, which number 17 addresses.
So when you said they were all completed, you meant they will be completed, because this one's not.
The 2013 need will be completed with the development of number 17.
Which is not yet complete.
Which is under process in development.
All right.
Yes. Number 14 for removing the PMIV from online registration is completed. That was removed. There was an option to add yourself and remove yourself from the PMIV list, and that has been removed from OOVR. So 14 completed. Yeah. 15, removing the PMIV from SCORE, is currently in development. So not completed, but being analyzed right now for removal with the Q4 release so that January 1, 2014, PMIV won't exist in SCORE anymore. Number 16 was harmonized with the pre-registrant bill, and OOVR on the registration messaging was updated. So number 16 would be completed. 17, updating the OOVR for the 8-day deadline we just discussed, and it is currently in development, but it will be released before the 8-day deadline. 19 and 19.2, those two are updating the affirmations and questions for the online registration. So that 2013 immediate essential need for the web form updates has been completed for 19 and 19.2. 20, the tall and skinny. CDOR that manages that system at DMV offices for printing out your registration information and having you sign it and sending it back to the clerk, affectionately known as tall and skinny development, is currently in process, and CDOS is waiting on a proof before approving the development to go forward, and they plan to have it available for 2014. So that one is in development as well. Item number 25, the activation of IFTV was completed before the needs assessment was released. So 25 was completed from the beginning. My next update isn't until item 38. Item 38 was probably the biggest need for 2013 for adding the voting method for in-person and also changing the early voting report to indicate that it's an in-person voting instead of early voting to be consistent with our terminology with the public. So 38 was completed with our Q3 release, which was a small release just before the coordinated blackout period for development. They actually used that version with the recall elections, but they did not conduct a mail ballot election, so most of the changes did not affect the recall election. Item 39, confirmation cards. This is currently in development and will be released with the Q4 release. This is a 2014 software development need. And it applies when you certify a general election. So it'll be available in January, but they won't use it until November. 40.1 is speaking again about the VSPC usage needs and having a web-based system instead of the Citrix. And the update on that is that we're currently analyzing the usage statistics from the recall election, and all of our indications are that, yes, it will require a substantial increase in users to support the VSPC model. And next steps on that is to closely monitor and support the coordinated election, and then later analyze the numbers from that election to just make sure what we're going forward with is what's actually needed. 40.2, this was the catch-all for the 2013 in-person paper was not available through the early voting module. And with 40.2, the software development was to enable the issuing of paper ballots at early voting. Terminology changes, so that is now in-person paper ballots are available in the system. That was released with Q3, and is available right now for the coordinated election. So that one is 40.2 is completed. We also modified the early voting reports for that one as well. Last update for me is 56. 56 with the SCORE development. This was one that is for the first ballot received is accepted. Previously, there were rules and policies, and we actually made changes to SCORE last year to adopt second ballot back functionality. And so this pretty much reverts it back to the old functionality. But we're not going to make any changes because the current ballot exceptions and current business processes, the functionality and score will warn any user of any voter that has multiple ballots out. So since the system will warn and alert users to every single situation of multiple ballots for a given voter, we feel that it'll warn the user, and they will follow whatever business process, rule, or policy is determined. So we don't think any software development is needed for that. So some of these items are completed for development in that there are no development needs. But the analysis has been done and discussion and looking through all the subgroup of business processes, we understand that the 2013 software development is completed and released to production. And we're ready to conduct an election. Yeah, I've already done that while I was waiting to be called. So we'll have Trevor be updating and providing new ones of this. Any questions? One?
All right, thank you, Trent.
Thank you.
Okay, I do have a question.
Oh, okay. Never mind, we have a question.
On number 20?
Yes.
This is Cindy Acree. On number 20, you had indicated that the system to correct this, address this issue was in development, but I thought you indicated it would not be needed in 2013, and the year needed on this report says 2013. Can you clarify that, please?
No, I believe that is from, this is actually from the needs assessment. But the year needed, 2013, it's a system that we don't manage. My understanding that CDOR's update was that they got approved funding to do the development, and they're not able to do it until 2014. I don't have a further update as far as...
So do we need it in 2013 then?
Well,
it was something that was needed
immediately.
A long time ago.
So we're
comply
just not
with NVRA.
We're going to need it, but we're not going to be able to provide it until
we haven't been able to provide it for years. I mean, they haven't been able to, so...
Yeah.
It's not our form. It's their development. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
I just have a question while we're on the form. Have we agreed on a process to get the business process inputs to this? I mean, do we?
Well, I think what we should do is probably have Steve send that spreadsheet out to Trevor and his group from our end, and then send it to Clerk Hall and her group, and then just give them access to go in and update what's theirs, and maybe have a way to identify, maybe color code whose issue is whose. Something like that. Yeah. So
we should readdress this next week because the 2013 election's coming on fast. If we have any holes in this, we ought to know what they are.
Okay. Yeah, we can get that back out and have people update them. All right. Skipping back to number 3, the business practices subgroup briefing document, and I think Clerk Hall's on the phone, and I believe Amber McReynolds is here.
Yeah, I am on the phone, and Amber is going to do a presentation how things are working at the. Walking through the committee on how things work in a voter service and polling center with some different scenarios. So we'll go ahead and have her do that, and then we'll take questions and look at what items are next to review with everyone. So Amber, if you would go ahead, that would be great.
Good afternoon. Amber McReynolds, I'm the Director of Elections in Denver and also a member of the Business Practices Group. And I apologize, I have a cold today, so hopefully folks can understand me. So we're here today. This is a presentation from the Business Practices Group. We've presented two other times. The first time was a high-level flow on the slide up here is the first flow that we presented, and this was from the voter's perspective. And then we presented a second, basically, decision-making flow that counties would utilize in the election as well. So this presentation is going to walk through this flow from the voter's perspective and sort of what will happen at the service center. And I'll point out some forms that will be filled out and also some of the interaction and score, along with some of the messaging that will pop up as safeguards for voters that might be moving across county or voters that have already submitted a mail ballot that's been validated. So a couple different points on here. Okay, so the first voter on the very top, I'm not going to go over. This is just simply a voter dropping off mail ballot at a service center or a drive-up or a 24-hour box. They basically just submit it into a box. The first, so voter number two in the second swim lane is a registered voter with a damaged mail ballot, so they would need to get a replacement. So the thought from the business practices group, and this is going to be basically the way that counties are going to do it, is as voters come into the service center, and this is similar to how we handled things last year in early voting, the voter will be asked for identification, primarily because that makes it easier to search the voter and score. So voter comes into a service center, they'll be asked for ID, they present that to the registration judge. The registration judge will search their record and score, and that basically allows them to triage what they might be coming to the service center for that day. So likely they need a replacement, they may need to update their address, they may not be in the system, so they need to register. So by searching them and sort of pulling up their record, we can identify why they may be there. So based on that, in this instance, they need to get a replacement because they've damaged their mail ballot. So they basically have two options. They can vote in person there, or they can also get a carry mail ballot to take home with them. So on the top of the screen, in sort of the blue, that would be a signature card. So if they're going to vote in person or either a paper or a DRE ballot, they would get a signature card. We'd place the score ballot label once we generate their credit and score right on the label, and then the voter would affirm that they're voting in person, they haven't cast another ballot, all those things. The other option for voting is that they could be issued a mail ballot to take home with them, and that's the gray, and that sort of highlights the affirmation that they would then complete on that. So those are some of the options for a registered voter with a damaged mail ballot. And you'll note on here, we don't have them completing a combo form just yet. That'll be on the next slides to come. So this is just a voter with a damaged ballot who has not changed their address or has not come from another county. So there's no reason for them to complete any information that would then be entered into the statewide system. The bottom half of the slide shows how does an election judge ensure that a ballot hasn't already been cast for this elector. So there's a couple different things that show up in score, and it's a little hard to see on the screen, but in the mail ballot module as well as the early voting module, it actually identifies if a vote has already been cast. So they would see a message that on the right side, if they had already voted early, it would show EV, or if their mail ballot had already been validated for some reason, it would show validated, and it would actually not allow them to be issued any sort of vote credit, either a flat ballot or a mail ballot in the screen. Any questions about that slide before I move on?
Amber, if I may, this is Fran.
Mm-hmm.
As I represent the smaller counties, I'd just like to point out there's just a couple of differences that smaller counties might do. We follow the exact same security. We would still use what you see on the bottom of the screen, but our voter registration cards would not be blue. And so if you're going into a different station, you wouldn't see necessarily that blue card. And as Amber goes through this, I'm going to point out just a few differences that a smaller or medium-sized county would do versus a larger county, just to give you an idea. But we all still follow the same security processes.
And that's a great point. The blue color is something that we do in Denver. Other counties may use a different color for the signature card. They may use a different style. Ours have to be translated, so we have both languages on our cards. That may not be the case in every county. So that's a great point. There are differences like that throughout. The bottom part, the score part, is exactly the same. Everybody uses that in the same way. So the next voter number three.
The part on the bottom, how does the election judge ensure the ballot has already been cast? Can we go back to previous?
Go back up. Perfect.
Where does that fit in those steps just above that?
So it's in the first two, basically. So when the election judge pulls up their record and score, they'll see some of those messages. So if the vote has already been validated or if they've already cast a ballot, they'll see some of that. And then in step two, if those messages aren't there and then they go to issue the ballot to them, those messages would pop up. So they'd see it basically while they're interacting with the election judge up front. So before there's a ballot involved, before a label's printed, before any of those things occur.
Thank you.
Okay, so voter number three, a registered voter who didn't receive their mail ballot due to a change of address. So this example is going to bring in an actual combo form that we're calling it, so a Colorado Voter Service and Polling Center information form. So this is the first step is the same. So the voter comes in, they present their ID, they are searched and score. We pull them up and find out that they need to change their address. They would then be handed the voter registration VSPCRF, I'll call it, form. And then they need to update their address, fill out that new information. Based on that new information that they provide on the form, as well as the self-affirmation, so the part that makes them attest to certain things to register to vote and change their address, they would complete all of that. Then the election judge, registration judge, would make those changes in score, save the record in the voter registration module. Then they would have the same option here as the previous voter, so they could vote in person, or they would also have the option of taking a mail ballot with them, and then they would proceed with the early voting module, which is where they can issue the ballot, or if they're going to take a mail ballot, they would also get they could get issued a mail ballot in that instance. So with this is where the form comes into play, because they need to update a record in the system. And the best way to think about this, and this is when we were in the business practices group, talked a lot about, the form and the voter registration form is going to be completed if there needs to be a change made to a record or there's a new voter registration. So if it's just a voter with a damaged ballot, or if they're just surrendering to vote on the accessible machine, as an example, they won't need to go through and complete a large form because there's not going to be a change made to their record. The form that they'll complete is the voting affirmation on a signature card or one on a mail ballot if they're getting a replacement. So this is, if they don't have an acceptable form of identification and they want to vote in person right here, also one of the things that'll happen is they'll be offered a chance to go and get their ID. So if they have it in their car or if they want to come back later, they'll be offered that chance, or they can vote a provisional and we'll defer them over to the provisional process, which we'll talk about later.
Yep. Could you tell me again, what's the blue card used for?
So that voter card, and ours just happened to be blue in Denver, so that would be for someone who's voting in person, not on a mail ballot envelope. So if they're just getting a flat ballot or they're voting on the DRE, they would be signing that as an affirmation. And on that card, we would place the score ballot label, which basically confirms that they've been issued credit in the score system. So for voting purposes, all voters would either complete a signature card if they're voting in person, and then that would have the label from score that was generated, or they would fill out a mail ballot envelope where they're affirming that they have not cast another ballot in the election. And then the form, the combo form that we mentioned here, is basically completed if they have to make a change to the record or if it's a new registration. So you have the form for score purposes, and then you have the signature card and the mail ballot envelope for voting purposes. And that helps us in the canvas when we go back and reconcile the ways in which people voted. So now we can say, okay, the forms, this is how all the changes were made in score, and then the signature cards were in-person voting, and the mail ballot envelopes were mail ballots that were cast. So that helps us reconcile and make sure everything balances out correctly. Any other?
I would also like to point out, this is Fran again, that any voter has always been able to come in and change their address and vote. This is not something in the new bill.
Yeah, this occurred last year, so this is consistent with how we handled things last year as well. Same process.
Except in the past, you had to live there for 29 days prior.
Yeah, and really the only change now is just in the self-affirmation and then the move date, which we'll talk about later with provisionals. But the form and the affirmation are very similar to how it was last year with just the modifications on the 29 to 22-day residency requirement.
But there's no residency for the district anymore.
For what district?
Well, there's no 22 days to live within the district in which you're voting.
There's 22-day Colorado residency right. requirement on the new affirmation.
Right.
And but there was never been a district residency on any form.
Well, you used to have to live in the precinct and the state for 29
precinct
days.
And state for yeah. 29.
Right.
But actually 30.
Right, but now precincts 30. Are eliminated, so.
Right, so precinct and residential address for 30 on the form last year, now 22-day Colorado residency requirement, and then the move date also on the form to confirm that.
Right, but no residency requirement except that present day to register if you've already been in the state 22 days.
If you've been in the state 22 days,
right.
Yes.
So there yeah. was a change to residency.
Not in the law.
Mm-hmm.
The intent language is still there. That's the same pre-1303.
Mm-mm. No.
Yeah, but
the intent to live at your residence pre-1303.
Right, but you still had to be there for 30 days before.
Yeah, you had to be there yeah. for 30 days, but the intent language around residency was there prior to 1303.
Yeah, but now you don't have to be there except on the day of election.
Because of the registration deadline
right.
change, not because right. the intent language changed. The intent on residency language has been there.
And is Denver going to accept the blue voter registration card as ID?
These cards, the signature
uh-huh.
cards, those are only issued at service centers, so no voter would be able to come in with that as ID. So those are only issued at, those are the cards that are actually issued with a label at the service center, so no voter would have that prior to coming in.
So they would only come in with their voter information card?
Which voter information?
You're still sending out information cards prior to elections to let people know where the service centers are?
We send out any required mailings, but in terms of if they met the identification requirements that are outlined in statute, then yes. But we don't send signature cards prior to a mail ballot election.
Okay.
Is that what? Like what we did last year with polling places,
right.
voters wouldn't be getting a VIC, if that's what.
Okay.
Is that what you're?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's not something we talked about on business practices at all. These cards would be at the service center already, not something the voter would actually have.
Okay.
So I know in the recalls, like they actually sent out signature cards or
right.
what have you to voters in advance. They wouldn't have that in this case.
Okay. What about the mail ballot? Can the mail ballot be used as an ID?
The mail ballot envelope or
yeah. The mail ballot. If you come in to surrender your mail ballot,
use
that,
it as ID.
Uh huh.
I don't
got
think
your
it's,
name and address on it.
I don't think it's ever
I mean, I think it will come up.
Yeah, I don't think it's come up previously, and the business practices group didn't discuss it. So it's certainly something we can talk about, but it hasn't come up previously.
We have a meeting on Thursday, and I'll add it to the list. But
yeah, we can add that to
for
the
us
list.
To discuss without making a snap decision, but we haven't discussed that. As I don't believe we think that is one, but we'll see.
If a voter comes in, who does the ID have to reflect the address where they intend to move? I mean, let's say I come in with my old address from a different district, but I've been in the state for the
mm-hmm.
required amount of time. I assume that I have to go through a change of address form if I state my intent to move to the new district, but the ID does not have to reflect a new address, I take it.
Yeah, so the way the identification requirements have been in existence, there are certain IDs that require the address to match, and there are certain IDs where the address doesn't have to match. Like a Colorado driver's license, that just has to be a Colorado address. It's always been that way. That's not new with this law. Passport doesn't have an address on it. So that can be used as ID, but it doesn't have an address on it. Some of the military identification also don't have addresses on them. So it kind of depends on the type of ID. An example of one where the address has to match would be the letter from the group residential facility director that verifies that someone is living in that group residential facility. That would have to match the address. Okay. And then the way that we've handled if someone has like an out-of-state ID, maybe a student or something like that that hasn't gotten a Colorado yet, that's where historically the utility bill has come into play, where they would say, well, this shows and proves that I'm living where I currently am because I have this utility bill type document. So depending on the type of ID, they may have to have an address that matches or they may not.
But the average voter coming in with, say, a driver's license to a different address, there's no requirement in the law that the address has to match.
No.
Yeah.
There is not. Not for Colorado.
Or for any other kind of ID. Any ID that has an address on it doesn't have to match the address you're registering.
I think the group residential facility letter does. And then
that's for a special category. But for somebody coming into a voter polling and service center.
Yeah, and most of the IDs don't have addresses on them. And that's historically been the case. Yeah.
But even the ones that do don't have to match. They just have to match the name. There's no address match.
Well, I think there's a couple instances of, yeah, they do. So the utility bill and the group residential facility bill, or group residential facility letter, yeah, they do. They have to match.
But not a driver's license. You don't have to change.
I think it's category G.
The driver's license has never had to match. It's had to be in Colorado. State ID and driver's license have never had to match. They didn't have to match last year or any previous years.
But you do have to vote in accordance with your address and score that's currently in score, unless you fill out a change of address form. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's part of the affirmation. So you're not only are you attesting that you're eligible in a Colorado resident for 22 days, but you're also attesting that it's your sole legal residence. And in the affirmation, there's the part about motor vehicle operation and income tax purposes. So the voter also has to make all those attestations when they're filling out the statement on the voter registration form. So they have to attest that all of those things are true and accurate. And I would point out too, and this came up last year in a polling place election. So voters that are marked inactive undeliverable in the mail ballot system, so for 1303 this year and going forward, they don't get a ballot sent to them because we've received notification that they are undeliverable. In a polling place election, that's not the case. So they can show up, and all they need to do is sign the poll book, even though there hasn't been any validation of their address. So last year, a lot of folks that come in to vote and they're inactive, undeliverable, they really just need to sign the poll book. And there hasn't been any additional validation, such as a mail ballot being sent or what have you, on their address. So there is that difference as well. We've had that come up and referred a few cases over to the district attorney when someone voted and they were an inactive undeliverable status, come to find out they're registered in another state. So in a polling place election, that is more of a problem. In a mail ballot, under 1303, the way it is, those voters would not be sent a ballot because we already know that they've moved. So there's more of a safeguard dealing with those types of electors than there is in an in-person or a polling place type scenario.
Have any of those ever been prosecuted?
I'm not sure. We've got a couple pending, so we'll see.
Under review, or?
They're pending right now with the district attorney.
In your history, have any of them ever been prosecuted?
We had one in 2005. It dealt with a mail ballot, a signature issue that was prosecuted. The ballot was never counted. It was caught, but the district attorney prosecuted based on a signature discrepancy. So most of the time, it's my understanding that the evidence is never good enough, or if it's an election judge error or something like that, it makes it difficult for the district attorney to prosecute.
also, this is Hillary, and it's also a lot of them, it's proving criminal intent as well. Often it's people not understanding the law, so they wouldn't prosecute in some of those instances. They would give a warning. And in those cases, the ballot hasn't been counted. That's where we had signature discrepancies, and the DA's office has investigated. So the ballot didn't count, and they also informed them, and we make a note of that they have already been warned. So if it comes up again, then we would prosecute. So far, we haven't had any of those instances.
Any other questions on this slide or any other issues? Okay. Number four, so registered voter who would like to surrender and vote in person, similar to the first slide, so they would just be able to surrender their mail ballot, and they either want to vote on a flat ballot, or in the more likely scenarios that they would want to vote on an ADA accessible machine. Same situation here, they would approach the counter, present their ID, their record would be brought up. We would need to void the mail ballot as long as it had not been returned or validated, and those similar messages would come up to the election judge so that they could see and verify that. As long as they had not already submitted a ballot according to the system, the ballot would then be voided, and they would then be issued an in-person ballot. The label out of score would be put on the signature card, and then they could proceed with voting. If they had already voted, a message would come up, would not allow them to void the ballot, and then they would be sent to a provisional. So there would be no way for them to get a second ballot in. And in addition to that, if they had come, voted in person, and then tried to submit their mail ballot on the back end, if they had not brought it in, because it had been voided, when it comes back to our office and we do signature verification, we would also get a notice at that point that the voter had already cast a ballot and that the election judge would not be able to accept it in the system. There's a couple different safeguards on that piece for this process.
Is this a prevalent problem? Do you experience, how many times have people tried to vote twice or more than once?
It's not a prevalent problem, and when we talked about it on the business practices call, it certainly isn't something that we see a lot. More often, we see somebody coming in on the last day of early voting because they went online and maybe saw that their ballot hadn't been processed yet, so they mailed it and felt like it hadn't got there. So if they had mailed their mail ballot and we potentially see that they haven't voted yet, it's called second chance kind of voting, they would want to vote in person then because they felt like we hadn't received it or something happened to it in the post office. So there are those instances, but it's certainly not a prevalent occurrence. Okay, and then similar, how does an election judge ensure that a ballot hasn't already been cast? Same messages that we had on a couple screens ago where it shows them right away if there's already been a validated ballot, and then it also shows on the back end if a mail ballot tries to come back in. So voter number five is the unregistered voter. So this, when they present their ID to the registration judge, and I do want to point out, I'm referring to registration judges. Some counties may have a check-in judge and then have the registration judge be separate from the check-in. A lot of counties are going to combine those efforts. I don't think we settled exactly on what we would recommend may allow counties to be flexible, because smaller counties, obviously, we're going to keep them as the same person because they have, in some cases, only a few staff at their service centers. Some of the other counties wanted to separate the two. Denver, as an example, we are going to have them combined because we've had that historically, and that is a best practice in terms of dealing with volume. So there might be differences amongst counties in that regard, but for the most part, the overall process is the same. So the voter is searched in SCORE, can't find a record for them, so they need to fill out the new registration form. They need to provide those attestations that they've lived in Colorado for 22 days and that they're at their residence. in the county. If all of those validations and eligibility requirements are met, they can get processed into the system. Once their record then validates in the CDOR system, so when they provide their driver's license number, that validates against CDOR, and it also checks the database for duplicate records within the SCORE database. Once that all happens, then the voter can be issued an in-person ballot, either on the DRE or paper, or a mail ballot to go with them. So there's a couple checks that happen when the election judges are actually scrolling through SCORE to validate the registration. And if the voter, for some reason, cannot attest that they've lived in Colorado, if they don't have the proper identification, if they can't say they're 18, if they can't say they're a citizen, if they can't do any of those eligibility requirements, this process would be stopped before they even complete the form, most likely, and they would be referred over to a provisional ballot.
So, Amber, can you compare this to the process that would happen if the reform were received at the county's office, say, 23 days before the election, how the process of entering into SCORE would differ, or how that check happens?
Yeah. So the process is the same. So we basically enter what we call a key line. So a new record is generated in SCORE. The key line is entered, which is the core information, so the voter's name, date of birth, and then the driver's license or state identification or Social Security number, whatever they provide. I should point out on the form, if they don't, they have to say that they don't actually have a driver's license or a state ID to provide the social. So they're prompted to say, you know, driver's license or state ID, and they have to provide that number. If they don't have one of those, they have to mark on the form that they don't have one, and then they can provide the social. And then that key line information, once you tab through, that's when the checks are run against the CDOR system, as well as a duplicate check within the SCORE registration system to check if they're in another county or to potentially check if there's a canceled record. And then also the CDOC and CDPHE system if there's recent data in there. And it's my understanding, at least from CDPHE, that there's going to be nightly transfers once the election actually starts. I haven't confirmed. I don't, Suzanne might be able to weigh in on that one, but we haven't, the business practices group hasn't received any confirmation of that piece.
It won't be done nightly. It'll be done weekly. Representative Hollinghorst had a question.
Thank you, Representative Dickie Lee Hollinghorst. Thank you, Amber. I was just checking this process that's used and described in number five. Is that what's used currently, has been used in the past with emergency voting and or provisional voting?
Yeah, very similar. So in the instance of emergency voting, if a voter does qualify to do emergency registration, this is exactly how it's processed. This was how it was processed last year at our voter service center. So those same things all happen in SCORE. The only difference is that with emergency registration in the old model, we would have to backdate the registration. So we'd have to backdate to the 29-day cutoff requirement to get SCORE to issue a ballot, because SCORE thinks that only voters that meet that deadline would qualify. So there was backdating going on. In the new model, it'll actually just be the date that the voter's standing there. So if they're standing there 4 days before the election, it'll be that date that goes into the system as the effective date. It no longer requires a backdating, which was problematic for many reasons. But this is exactly how we did this last year with emergency registration.
Well, the backdating was actually just the affirmation of when the voter said they attempted to register, wasn't it?
It was backdating to the instructions from the SCORE. From SCORE, from your office, are to the voter registration deadline, so 29 days prior.
Right, because that was voters saying that they had attempted to register prior
them, yes,
to the cutoff date.
So them saying that they had to attempt to register, even though they signed the date on the form as election day or whenever it was, even though the date on the form says that, we still had to backdate it in the system. So when we go back historically, pull up a record, it has a date prior to what's actually on the voter affirmation and what date the voter actually signed it.
Well, the date the clerk received it, the voters affirming they signed it before.
the date in the system,
right.
The registration date, the effective date, the voter actually signs on the form.
Right, I
October
understand
20th,
that.
Whatever. In the system, it's going to think October, whatever day it was last year, I think 4th. So in the system, it would say that, even though the voter actually made the attestation on the 20th or whatever. So the dates
right.
would be different.
Yeah.
Because in emergency registration, they have to affirm that they try to register. And really, all they're doing is affirming that they attempted to register. They don't have to provide any proof. And similar to provisionals, which I think was the other part of the question, after the election, if a voter is a provisional, there is registration. The registration of the voter going forward happens in a similar way. With provisional voting, there are additional checks, so we have access to the motor vehicle database to check history or how long they've potentially been at the address or what have you to see if they're eligible for their provisional. So there's other checks that happen with provisional, but generally, in terms of entering it into the system, it's similar.
Still confused on Cindy Acree. I'm still confused based on the language in the statute how and when we are required to verify local residency when the statute seems to specify you only have to live in the state for 22 days prior to voting and removes the old language regarding precinct requirements for precincts. So if the statute clearly says any elector is permitted to vote in any primary, residential, general, coordinated, special, legislative, municipal, congressional vacancy, special district, or other election, as long as you meet that 22-day timely registration requirement, then why do counties have to verify local residency at all? It appears to me that we have the ability to be fluid and vote in any election in any place in the state.
So you still have to vote at your sole legal residence. So that's still part of the affirmation of voting, and it's also part of the questions answered by the elector in 12204, I think it is, which is where there's citizenship and other eligibility requirements. And that is also where the motor vehicle operation as well as the income tax purposes language comes from that's on the voter affirmation. There's questions that have to be answered by the elector when they're registering to vote. And there's a lot of requirements outlined in there. Including sole legal residence. So they can't go from address to address to address all over the state changing their registration if they can't affirmatively say that that's their sole legal residence. And that is the same as it was last year at 29 days or 22 or 10 or 5 or whenever. I mean, it's still that language and those questions that the voter has to affirm are no different than they were last year leading up to the election and no different on 29 or sooner dates.
But I think the point is there's no requirement on the county to affirm that. I mean, because the ID, some forms of ID do not require
address.
Address. So in fact, we're depending on voter affirmation on the in this case.
Yeah, and it's been that way. And that's it. That was that way last year at 29 days or 45 or however long. It's always been based on the voter affirmation. And I can speak even more to this because I'm also one of the only counties that's had a challenge to a voter registration that actually went to a hearing in recent memory. We had one of our voters was challenged, his residency was challenged, and we had to hold a hearing. And even though for, you know, income tax purposes, for school registration of his children, everything were in a different county, he used the intent language to say that he was intending to return to his address in Denver. And so that was two, three years ago. So this is the same as it's been, and based on the voter affirmation and the voter saying, this is my sole legal residence for voting purposes. And it didn't change with the new bill other than the requirement for registration.
Go ahead.
Cindy Acree. I respectfully am going to have to disagree with you on the interpretation of the statute because there's two separate sections. One is eligibility to register, and the other is questions that you can ask. And the things you mentioned, I agree, are questions that you ask, so residency, are you 18, those type of things. But under the requirements for registration, it does not say that. And when we removed the precinct requirement for living in the precinct, we did change the statute, so it's not the same as it was last time. So I really think that we've got an issue with this, and trying, if we're going to go to multiple voting locations outside a precinct, then are we putting too much onus on individual counties to verify something they're not required to verify?
So the other part of that, previously, so last year, the problem that exists with requiring the precinct is that we maybe have, say, an elector moved to Denver 28 days before the election last year from Jeffco. Our response was, well, you need to go back to Jefferson County and vote in that election. Even though you don't live there, you are probably going to have trouble signing an affirmation stating that you live there. Your option is to go back to Jefferson County, vote in an election that you no longer care probably too much about since you've moved away from your residence. And so we've had that, we've sort of had this 30-day problem with the previous registration that disallowed individuals that were moving into a new county to participate in elections that they were now relevant to their life wherever they happen to live. And so it would require us to issue a provisional that wouldn't count, likely, because they don't qualify at the 30-day cutoff, or they have to go back to a previous county and vote in an election that no longer is relevant to them. So there's that problem, which is a big problem, because that's voters that shouldn't be voting on things that no longer matter to them. And then there's the new problem of them residing in the district, to your point, shorter. What is better from the voter's perspective? And I would argue that it's better for them to vote on things that matter to them in their new district where they live than it does for them to go back and vote on things that no longer matter to them. So that, I mean, that is part of the problem that we had prior to this year as well.
Let me just take, go ahead.
Thank you. Dickie Lee Hollinghorst. So the thing that has changed here as far as verifying where somebody lives and where somebody has cast a ballot, it relates to the online score and statewide score, so that allows for statewide portability as opposed to precinct portability, does it not? So that it doesn't have an additional burden on counties to verify that, because that's all verified through the statewide score, so that you can ensure that someone isn't going to three different counties and saying this is my place of residence and voting when in fact that can be determined, or that whether and or registering in three different counties in Colorado, that can be determined. And that's what permits, which is a huge voter service in Colorado, because there are lots of problems for people who moved to another permanent address within that 30-day period last time and now 22-day period. So this solves that problem, but it gives every county the ability through the score system to verify that.
And the address does have to be checked against our address library. So we have an address library that has validated addresses and ranges for each county. And so when they're submitting their address and that change is being made in the system, those verifications are happening. So if they provide an address that isn't in, say, the address library, the system's not going to let the judge process that. They're going to have to go to a provisional.
Yeah, go ahead, Cindy.
Cindy, agree. The statute is clear on that once you register at a new address, it vacates your old address. My concern is, how do we prevent people from voting in elections where they don't have a vested interest in influencing elections in places where they don't live? Because according to the statute, the residency, not just the how long they've been there, but actual location is really important. So how, either it is important enough that we want to keep people voting in their own local municipal elections or own district elections and not in other elections where they don't have an vested interest. So the verification of that address and how long they've lived there has got to be a critical piece of this verification process.
And Representative Rankin, what's to prevent a person from moving temporarily and filling out the affirmation that I intend to move there, but there's certainly no penalty for changing your mind later and not permanently moving or living there temporarily, I mean, or asserting that you do, to influence a local election or special election.
And that's the, I mean, that existed last year. People can do it. I mean, I keep saying this, but people can do it at 30 days just like they can do it at 10 days prior. It is based on the voter affirming that that's their sole legal place of residence for voting purposes and then for the other items listed in there. And so if it comes to be, I mean, I, as an election official, have no way of verifying that someone is, their refrigerator's full of current food, that they're, other than us standing outside of a house at night, making sure someone goes in and out, there's no magical database that says, oh, so-and-so lives at a particular residence for a certain length of period of time and they've moved something. I mean, there's no way for, and there, we've never been able to do that.
But Amber, in the past, didn't you send a notice after they registered?
I would also like to address the question that Representative Rankin asked, which is what's to prevent someone from doing this. It's illegal. It's highly illegal.
And could you talk about, there is a process to challenge.
So.
Well, it has been illegal. I mean, it clearly states on the affirmation that they signed for voter registration as well as a mail ballot or a voter card that it is against the law for them to falsely affirm to those qualifications. And so if they're willing to go and deal with the penalties, then that's, you know, that's a different issue. My guess is that's not the case, and we haven't seen that be the case. There haven't been a ton of convictions around it.
But didn't however, you just say convictions are based on supposedly people understanding what the law is? That's what you're being told by your DA?
It's based
on criminal intent.
Couple of pending.
Right, criminal intent I never understood criminal to mean intent. You had to know what the law was, but...
And criminal. And that, right, this that doesn't have anything to do with it. It's new like if they can prove criminal intent.
And this isn't a new issue with 13. I mean, this happened in polling place elections, and I would actually argue that with voters being sent a mail ballot, that's an address verification in and of itself. With a polling place election, we didn't have an address verification. We have inactive undeliverable voters. They can come in, they can sign the poll book. They don't have to fill out a form. They could just sign the poll book and attest to living at their residence. So, I mean, we have all of that going on previous to this particular legislation. Now, by sending a mail ballot, that is address verification in and of itself because they're not forwardable. So if we get notice that it comes back undeliverable, that's another issue that we can look at for potentially the district attorney or sending a confirmation card to that voter. Maybe they moved out of the county. So this isn't suddenly a change in terms of what the voter affirms to, the questions they have to answer. And the only change is that the timeline in which they do it. And it doesn't change the penalties, the false affirmations that they're potentially making, or the fact that it's illegal.
One quick thing before we go to the rest of the commission. Hillary Hall was trying to say something on the phone, and we kind of spoke over her a little bit. Could we give her a second to speak to what she was trying to address earlier?
Yeah, I'm good. We at the moment already passed. It's fine. And Amber's spot on with where she's headed. So thank you, though.
I guess my point was with the mailing that before when you had to register at 29, they got a mailing in between. And if it bounced back, then you knew before the election that there was a problem.
Potentially,
now you don't know till after.
Potentially we knew. Sometimes we didn't get it back till after the election.
Right, but there was that additional time period to research and investigate it, and that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it does. It's been replaced with mail ballots actually being sent. So because mail ballots are going, we also will get that back undeliverable. Like in Denver with our ballot trace system, we know that the undeliverable ballots we're going to have within 4 days of them being at the post office, which is well in advance of an election.
I'm talking about a same-day registrant.
So somebody who registers in person?
Right. And okay. Votes that yeah. day. Yeah. Yeah, they're not going to get a mailing. There's not going to be any check.
They'd get a mailing later, but they're making those affirmations, and they need to be comfortable making those affirmations, because I think if we get a mailing back, if we register someone to vote on Election Day, and then the mailing that we send to them to verify that and confirm that change, we get that back undeliverable, that's likely going to be turned over to the district attorney for investigation if it's not a valid address that they provided, just like it was last year, just like it would have been in previous years, in previous mail ballot elections.
But as we've already found out, it's never prosecuted, and now we're not going to know till after the fact. I mean, you've turned those over in the past, but they're not prosecuted, are they?
Well, we haven't turned over a significant number of the ones, like the example I used where we've got one or two pending with the district attorney. That instance hasn't been turned over a lot because we haven't had evidence that someone falsely affirmed a voter card on Election Day. And in this instance, we did. So we, you know, turn that over and turned over the information we have. We turn over discrepancies. We turn over signatures that don't match. We turn over undeliverable things if they voted at the address they say, and then we got something back on. We do turn those things over, and it's just a matter of what the district attorney can do with it. And I know there's a working group that's been talking to the DAs about making some of that process better.
This is Fran. Isn't that one of the purposes of the NCOA is to help find those address changes? If we do them on a monthly basis, there, it falls within that 22-day, and we should be able to clean that up somewhat?
The national change of address checks do help with some of the undeliverable mail or validating addresses. So by doing that on a regular basis, in theory and likely, the list should be cleaner, and we should see less undeliverable ballots. But I think Deputy Steyer was referencing the registrations on Election Day.
Right.
So it would be different in that
but
instance.
But I would think with the NCOA, if you were looking at those records on a monthly basis and someone's affirming that they moved 22 days, even if they come in on same-day registration, they said, I've been here for 22 days, but you're finding records that are to the opposite, that's something that you could challenge right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
This is Cindy Agree. My question really has nothing to do with the residency requirement for date, for how long they live there, but more to do with the language in the bill that allows you to vote in any election without specifying that it has to be in your district, that you have to live in the district. How do we protect district elections or municipal elections or other special elections from people voting in districts where they're not residing?
And I think part of the problem is there's a disconnect between the law and the affirmation. And so there's an affirmation that says you must affirm to all these things, but there's no tie-in that in order to vote, the registration law doesn't say, you know, and all these things are required. So that's what we were trying to do when we put the rule out, was stitch together that affirmation piece with the voter registration law and say that in order to register, you have to meet all these things. And that's what the court threw out. So we don't have a rule that ties together that affirmation piece. They would almost be separate prosecutions. One for, I guess, falsely affirming something, but you wouldn't be prosecuted for voting illegally. You would be prosecuted for some kind of perjury, I guess.
Legitimately say.
Okay, this is Martha Tierney on the phone. Can I jump in? I think that, you know, we're taking an example, the Caldera example, where he clearly violated the law and blowing it up. And I don't think that we're going to see that happened in this election other than in that instance or very few instances. And, you know, I could rob a bank tomorrow, but it's against the law. And they don't have metal detectors going into banks because that would restrict our lives far too much. So we have to open our system of voting to try to enfranchise most people. And our new bill does that. And Suzanne, to be clear, the court threw out the rule because the rule didn't track the statute. So yeah. Let's make sure that that's clear.
No, I admit that. The affirmation has nothing to do with the registration.
Absolutely.
So you're right. It doesn't track the law because the affirmation, you don't have to, those things don't have to be true to vote.
Can I finish, please? So you do, Amber was correct, that you can only have one legal residence. And John Caldera lied when he said that Colorado.
You know, I'd be a little careful. I mean, you don't know anything about what his intentions were. And so I'm just going to stop you from, you know, just slandering him. You don't know where he's living.
You
don't know what he's doing. I don't. And I haven't said I do. You have twice said he lied.
Could we recognize Representative Hollinghorst, please?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is State Representative Dickie Lee Hollinghorst. Maybe we can get this down to a little more order here. I understand what Cindy Akery's question is and the concern about intent. And I would just like to verify with Martha or someone else who has been very familiar with the voting statutes, and also you, Hillary, and you, Amber, that the fact of the matter is that there is, in the statutes, it's very clear that in order to register and to vote, because the only reason you register is to vote, that you have to declare that the address you put on your address form for purposes of voting is your sole legal residence. And there are any number of questions that you ask. What follows then, when you do that, is then you are eligible to vote at that address, and you are eligible to vote at that address if you have lived in Colorado for 22 days. And it's the issue of portability between precincts that I think you go to. But you, at the same time that you are eligible to register, having lived in Colorado for 22 days, you have to verify that this is your address, that you're declaring your sole address for purposes of voting. And you could have moved there 2 days before or whatever, but you have to have lived in Colorado for 22 days. Now, the reason that was done is that there are lots of people who do that, who move a lot within Colorado, who move from one address to another in the same county but not the same precinct, and a number of things like that, where it's very important that those people be allowed to vote if they choose to do that at the address that they're in, for because that's what they're going to be concerned about in the future. So that was how that was set up, but there was nothing that was changed by 1303, in my opinion, and I think that's been confirmed by the county clerks, that changes what the law requires there, which is you have to register at the address you consider to be your sole address, and you have to have lived in Colorado for 22 days. It seems pretty simple to me. And it also seems pretty simple to me that if you choose to not, you know, to declare an address and then not live there or be there, that's clearly illegal and you cannot vote. Now, if we need to clarify that, I think we could in the statute. What the Secretary of State did in the rulemaking that the court threw out, it confused that whole issue completely. It's very clear in the statute, in my opinion, both 1303 and the previous statute, what the law is, what's legal, what isn't legal, and I think this process that you've set out works pretty well. But I understand your question. I just think it's not an issue.
Cindy Akery. Let me read you the language directly from the bill. My question has nothing to do with intent or declaration of where you live. I think the residency requirement's fine. I think that the declaration's fine, and it's not what is required for registration I'm concerned about. It's what is allowed by the new law in the language in the bill. So I want to read this to you under 1-2-201. It says, an elector is permitted to vote in any primary, residential, general, coordinated, special legislative, municipal, congressional vacancy, special district, or other election if he or she timely registers to vote. It does not specify limiting it to the elections you can vote in just your district. I think this is a problem for the ability to vote in any election, and it's perfectly allowable under this statute.
No, you can only vote once. This is Martha Tierney, and
sure,
the score system will be able to make sure that a voter only votes once. You
but
don't get to vote. There's no allowing under any statute to vote more than once.
And this is Elena. The statute also is you have to be able to register to vote. So you can't register to vote if you don't meet the qualifications, which would mean being 18 years old, a citizen, and then being a resident of the state and affirming your residency in the place where you intend to vote. So it's not that you can just say, I think I'd like to go vote someplace if you're not eligible.
But I think there's an issue here that would be a question, a matter settled by a court, because I don't agree that this particular question doesn't have anything to do with registration. This has to do with where you can vote. In what election are you allowed to vote in? And I think we open Pandora's box by the language in this bill.
Well, just to follow up, I think that section, the 122013A that you were reading, I think that has to do with the timeline for registration. It's not about qualifications. I think that's addressed elsewhere in the statute.
Well, yeah, qualifications to vote, and then the affirmation in 17110. So I, who reside at the address listed and am eligible elector of this precinct or district and desire to vote at this election. And that's the affirmation in 17110 that's required. And then there's also the mail ballot affirmation, but that's the one specifically for in-person situations. So I think
but they're two different things, and the affirmation does not align with the language in the statute.
With the registration for registration purposes. So that's, I mean, and they've never, to be frank, they never have. So the question's answered by the elector in 12204, and then I think it's 12205 for the registration affirmation. Am I right on that? I think that's right. And then in Article 7 is where the voting affirmations actually live in statute. So they all have to be combined together to talk about registration and the new system with registering and when they can register in Colorado. So they're two different, because you're registering to vote and then you're voting, which is also why we, on this presentation in particular, differentiated between the registration form that would be used to enter information into SCORE and then the forms used for voting purposes. So the affirmation that they'd sign if they were going in person to vote or the affirmation on the mail ballot envelope, because they all sort of work hand in hand in terms of the system as a whole.
If we could have the chair look for people who would like to speak and recognize them when they're raising their hands, please.
Sure.
Go ahead, Representative Hollinghorst.
No, I think maybe somebody who was ahead of me. I just raised my hand.
Yeah. No, you've had your hand up multiple times.
Thank you. This is Dickie Lee Hollinghorst again, and I would also call your attention to Section 8, 12201, which does somewhat tie the regulations for registration to voting. And the issue is that there are several different processes, and the law applies to several of those processes. That doesn't mean that just because you say something in one section of the law, it makes it completely legal, not taking into consideration the other processes that are defined as legal requirements in the law. And that's the only way I can answer that. And I think it was at least the last court case, it was pretty clear that the law was clear. In this particular issue, it wasn't the rule that was clear. So.
This is Elena Nunez. So just, Amber, I just want to make sure this is super clear. When we're talking about the change that was done in Section 8, that only had to do with the change of when, if you turned your form in on time, you would be allowed to vote. You still had to read the other parts of statute to get to the eligibility requirements and the affirmation. So it's not the 1303 changed that. It simply allowed you to register up through Election Day, but you still have to read those other pieces of statute to get to the affirmations and the standards, and it's not that they were somehow removed because these changes were made in 12201.
Yeah, they're just in different parts. I don't have that in front of me, so I don't want to speak to that, but the affirmations and the questions are in 12204 and 205, and then the affirmations for voting are in Article 7.
Anyone else?
I think Representative Ignatius. No.
Amber, do you want to go on?
Yeah, I have one more. You want me to go quick, or do you want me to stop? Or
no, go ahead.
I have time. Okay. So the sixth one that we want to talk about today is the provisional ballot voter. So once we check in the voter and sort of figure out why they're there that day. There's a couple different reasons now that they could end up on a provisional ballot. They potentially don't have proper ID. That's a normal one where we see some for. They don't meet the eligibility requirements. So if they have not lived in Colorado for 22 days, if they're not 18, if they're not a citizen, any of those reasons where they wouldn't meet the eligibility requirements. Potentially they're on a felon status and they don't have, they can't affirm that they're otherwise off of that. Also potentially that they don't live in the county where they're trying to register. Voter is successfully challenged, so if they're challenged while they're attempting to register to vote and they can't affirm any of the challenge questions, they would then be considered successfully challenged and they'd be referred to a provisional, and if they've already cast a ballot in the election. So if we look up in the system and they've already returned their mail ballot and they're trying to come vote on a DRE, they would be referred to a provisional in that instance. So the process with that, they're issued a provisional. Most counties are going to have supervisor judges or provisional ballot judges specific to that process that have voters complete that piece. And then they'd mark their provisional and they'd put it in an envelope and then into the ballot box. And then after the election, all of the validation and eligibility checks are done on those provisionals to determine if they need to be counted. In our experience with mail ballot elections, and this comes from the business practices group as a whole, we see a lot less provisionals as we do in the polling place early voting mail ballot elections that we've had last year. And so we see a lot less provisionals, likely because, as we've been discussing, because of the registration requirements changing, a lot of those provisionals that were previously accepted and counted are no longer going to be provisionals. They're going to be normal ballots with the changes in registration where we allow individuals that have moved within that time period to come and register in their new county of residence. So really the provisionals are going to be mostly these issues that are laid out on this slide. Any questions about provisionals?
Go ahead.
Okay.
This is Elena. I've got one question. We've talked about this a little bit, but it seems like part of the reason that a voter might vote a provisional ballot is because they can't sign the affirmation that they meet all of the requirements. So, for example, if they're voting out of county or if they're out of state or, you know, for whatever reason, they can't actually affirm that they meet all of the eligibility requirements. So how does the affirmation work? Because it seems like in that case, it would make sense to allow the voter to affirm to what they can. And if it was something like a voter who'd moved to Colorado 5 days ago, they wouldn't be able to vote because they didn't meet the residency requirement, but you would want to be able to set them up to be registered in the future without having them perjure themselves by saying that they actually did meet the residency requirement. So,
yeah, we provided, I talked to the state staff about that issue because that's actually been an issue previously with the provisional affidavit. The provisional affidavit in Colorado has been traditionally the voter registration affidavit so that it could be used for registering in the future. That affirmation is problematic for a lot of voters that may be voting provisional because, like you mentioned, if they can't affirm that they live in Colorado for 22 days, they can't sign an affirmation that they live in Colorado for 22 days. However, by federal law, they're supposed to be allowed to vote a provisional. So the affirmation on the provisional that is currently approved is a bit problematic for that reason, and that was the case last year as well, and it has been the case for a few years, and it's really just because there's been a goal of trying to make it a registration form for registering in the future. So there is that problem because they do have a right to get a provisional under federal law, but I would say that they would have a problem signing that affirmation if they aren't eligible and if they're not 18 or whatever it is. So I think it would be a good issue to look at further.
Amber, I have a question about, and this may not pertain to Denver, but maybe it's been discussed at the group. For the municipal elections that are coming up, and we'll have a number of those in the state, where the residency requirements will be different than obviously what's in 1303, will there be two affirmations to sign? What are people planning to do with the ballot styles?
So I'm not sure how many. I've heard there's a few jurisdictions that have a challenge. Denver is home rule charter,
right,
and we have an ordinance that says we follow Title I. So we don't have any of those registration requirements that are specific to Denver. those jurisdictions that do have that, if it's an ordinance issue and they can change it, my guess is maybe they would try to do that before the election. If it's a charter change, I'm not sure if they can do an ordinance similar to what we did where we follow and defer to Title I. I'm not really too familiar with how some of those are handling it just because we don't have that particular instance. And it may be that there's a separate ballot style. But it seems like there's a few different options for how something could be handled. And I'm not, it's my understanding there's a few situations where this is an issue, and I don't know if it's a widespread problem or not.
Representative Rankin?
Is there any provision that says voters successfully challenged? Do we in any case ever challenge a voter's affirmation? I mean, are we just completely on the honor system so that if they will affirm something, it becomes true? Do we ask questions? Do we ever try to actually verify that the information is accurate, or do we always just accept it?
Historically?
Or currently?
Yeah. I mean, historically and currently, the voter registration system and voting is affirmation-based for the most part. Obviously, you have to provide your state ID number or your driver's license number or your social. And it's very rare that anyone would say they don't have any of those. I don't think we have very few voters that are able to say I don't have any of those numbers. And then that's the way voting has been, is it's been affirmation based, and it's been based on individual responsibility of the voter to say yes, I can affirm to all of these things, and I'm eligible. And then we check eligibility, you know, if they're in the deceased record file, we check that. We've flagged those individuals as being deceased. We flag the felons as being on a felony status and not eligible. If their date of birth is not such that they would be 18, we would not be able to validate and enter and issue a ballot to them. And if they can't affirm that they're a citizen, so if they leave the citizenship box blank and then they can't sign the affirmation, that also they're not eligible and they would vote a provisional, likely not be registered if they can't affirm to those instances.
And how do we compare, and some of you who know elections a lot better than I do, how do we compare to other states in verifying voter eligibility?
This is Elena. I'm not aware of other states that have verification processes that are different than ours. I think a lot of it tends to be affirmation-based. There may be states that do it differently. I just don't know. But Amber, can you also speak to the challenge process where someone who does challenge another voter's eligibility, whether it's an election judge or a poll worker, and then there are a series of questions that the voter has to answer? Because I think that was what Representative Rankin was asking about as well, what that process looks like.
Yeah, and so the first question, it's my understanding that Colorado does it very well in terms of the verification with motor vehicle and things like that, that not all states have some of those interplays with different state databases. I think California, for instance, is just now getting onto a statewide database where they haven't been previously. So it kind of depends where you go. I have some experience in Iowa. They have same-day registration. And they explained some of the ways that they've handled it, and they haven't seen many problems with it either. So I think it's probably different wherever you go. Wyoming, there's no registration requirement at all. Everybody's in a database. They don't have to do anything extra to register. So I think you've got varying degrees of how folks are doing it across the country, but it's my understanding that the score system is fairly good at validating and interplaying with those other databases. In terms of the challenge process, there's two different challenges processes that are in statute. There's one that deals with registration that's prior to an election period. So an elector in a county can challenge an individual's registration based on them not living there or, you know, that they don't believe that they're a resident of the county. That's the example that I mentioned earlier. We actually had a challenge of a voter's registration early in 2011, and we had to hold a hearing and investigate that challenge. And all of the same issues with intent, residency, all of that were part of that discussion. The second challenge process is one that occurs during the election process. So if a voter is challenged in person when they're coming in to vote in a service center, or a mail ballot challenge can also occur. So one of the voting challenges, they can challenge in person based on residency, age, or citizenship. So those are the three ways. And then in a property owner type election, they can also challenge somebody's right as a property owner. So that's the fourth one in a property owner. And then there's the mail ballot challenge process that can also occur sort of in the midst of an election. And in those challenges, the voter has to affirm to certain things. And if they can't affirm to them, or if they can't answer certain questions in the correct way, then they would be referred to a provisional and not allowed to vote a normal ballot.
Anyone else?
Okay.
Any other questions for Amber while she's here?
I do. Amber, on the self-affirmation, if you chose to prosecute it, what is that process? And is the Secretary of State involved? Do they have any rules, or do they help with this at all?
For on the voter registration or the voting?
The voting.
The voting. So that's just part for us, at least, and I think most counties handle it this way. After the election, you know, we gather everything that we feel needs to be returned over to the district attorney based on our obligations in Title I. So mail ballot signature discrepancies, provisionals where maybe there was a successful challenge, if someone attempted to vote twice, so if they voted a mail ballot and then they ended up getting issued a provisional that maybe wasn't counted, we would still refer that over because we have an obligation to. And then if there's any issues like this with somebody affirming that they were there and then they really weren't, or they were registered in another state. We've had a couple of those come up where we get information that they're registered in another state, and then we would obviously turn that over to the district attorney if there was an issue like that in an election. So.
Anything else? All right. Thank you, Amber. Do you have more?
Yeah, but I kind of covered them. I mean, just real quick, there's a couple different score verifications. I went over them earlier, but they're on this slide, so you can look at them further. And then at the end of the presentation, this is the same process flow chart that we had presented a few meetings ago. And then I inserted, the quick guide that we're using that's similar to the process flow, but it just gives more instructions to the registration judges in person at the voter service centers so that they have a quick decision-making guide on how to process a record within the system. And I know a lot of counties are using something similar, so I went ahead and included that in this presentation. And then just questions if there's any further.
Representative Rankin?
I just have an observation, and thank you, Amber. It's great work and presentation, but this is really for the commission. You know, my feeling is that we have a huge public perception problem coming off this recall election, you know, and part of our job here ought to be to wring these issues out so that to the extent possible, the public has confidence in the election law and the processes that are being used. To the extent they don't, you know, we're just going to face continuing public pressure in the next elections. So I think this commission ought to really take very seriously any problem. I mean, we may have different opinions on it, but we should be thinking about the public perception of this process and what we can do to either recommend changes to the process or perhaps educate the public. I mean, I just want to make that, I mean, I think that we could tend to be insular and discuss it among ourselves, but we need to be thinking about what the public perception of our work and the election process really is.
Thank you, Amber. Really appreciate you doing this presentation. It was really informative.
Yep. Thanks.
Thank you.
Is that all we have on that or Clerk Hall?
So we had some next steps, and I didn't know if we wanted to continue that as the rest of the report from the business practice group or to talk about it when we talk about agendas for the next meeting, because this was part of what the commission had asked the group to look at and report back on. So would we prefer to wait till we talk about upcoming agendas or continue with what the next steps are from the business practice group?
whatever you prefer. If you want to continue, we can.
Okay, great. So the next thing is what we're looking at, the mail ballot processing was the other portion that the group had asked us to come back and present for the committee. And what we would like to suggest is if we could do a field trip meeting, and we've already arranged this with Amber at the Denver office so that we could talk about the mail ballot process and you all could see it in practice at their facility. There's room for the public to attend as well based on the numbers of public that have currently been attending. And the date for that would be our October 7th meeting, so it's a couple weeks away. So I wanted to put that before the committee. And the other pieces will be sending out one of our voter service manuals just so you all can also see the effect of the collateral that's being created for the service centers as well. So I guess first up, does the commission want to have a field trip meeting? We could hold the whole meeting there, I'm assuming, Amber. Would that work? She's still there.
Yeah, she's coming back up.
Yeah, that works fine. And I know the other part we discussed was even a quick demo of like a voter service center with the mail ballot process. So sort of both.
Yeah, we just having a real visual. Yeah, I forgot about that.
If
thank
that
you
helps
for reminding
people,
me.
We can certainly set something like that up.
So. Right. Is that something the commission wants to do on the 7th?
Yeah, okay. I think that'd be great.
All right, Steve, let's go ahead and schedule that for the 7th. Post it. Anybody have any other questions? Did you have anything else, Hillary?
No, I just was just sort of giving you our list of to-do items. We're going to continue to drill down into the processes. Did the commission have any other items that they were wanting this group to report back on? Those are the ones that I had on my list. In addition to mail ballot as ID, we have a meeting this Thursday. We'll be sure to add that to the list. I know the other process we're looking at for going forward is the NCOA process as well.
Representative?
Thank you. This is Dickie Lee Hollinghorst, and thank you, Clerk Hall. I also think that we should, that this committee should address those issues that were identified on the score on the sheet that we just saw with the first presentation on score that were identified as probably a business practices issue. And I don't know whether you have that in front of you or listen to that part, but I think it would be good for us to, I think that the staff is going to identify those issues, and I believe the first best thing would be for the Business Practices Committee to take a look at those and to report back to us as to what's going on.
So I wasn't quite on the phone yet due to some of the flooding issues that we've been working on. Is that possible for Deputy Sarah, for someone to send me what that list is, or is it already marked? I've seen the spreadsheet. Is it already marked on that particular spreadsheet?
Yeah, it's just in an Excel, I think. So okay. I was going to have Steve send it out to you to edit and identify which issue were part of the kind of clerk side, and then send one to Trevor and have Trevor identify which ones are our programming issues.
Great. I'll send it out to the committee also for them to take a look, and then, or the practice group. Sorry, I'm mixing up terms. For the business practice group to look at and see what they think as well, and I'll add it to Thursday's agenda.
Okay, great. We'll get that out to you then.
Great. Thank you.
So I think the next item on the agenda, unless anyone has any other questions or comments, is the mock election documents, and we had submitted. Elena?
Oh, sorry. I think we had the NCOA update after business practice on the agenda.
Oh, do we?
At least on mine, yeah.
Oh, I guess I'm looking at packet contents. All right, NCOA update. I think Trevor was here to do that. No?
Well, I actually,
Trevor's not here to do that.
I had a question maybe that'll help frame out the update. Okay. On one of the last business practice calls, it seems like that's something that the group is taking on, which I think is appropriate. But there was also discussion that there is another working group being formed within the Secretary of State's office with other clerks to also work on it. So really, I had asked to have it put on the agenda more for a process conversation about how we should be coordinating implementation of 1303 and whether it should be all going through the business practice subgroup, or if not, you know, how to make sure that that goes through the commission so that we're all on the same page.
Amber, do you, is there a separate group being formed for NCOA? I don't know anything about it, if there is.
It was my understanding that, I think, I don't know if it was the last, it might have been the NCOA calls that were had. Vicki Steckline requested that counties send in emails if they wanted to be a part of it, and that they were gonna, you guys were going to set up a separate group that wasn't the business practices group. And we submitted an email. We haven't heard back, so we haven't heard back anything, but we did send an email requesting to be a part of it. So that's all I know.
Oh, okay. So Vicki Steckline is, she's manager of the SCORE, the help desk. So looks like they're looking at it from a highly technical standpoint.
So I have a quick question. I need some clarification here. We're talking about SCORE, the NCOA implementation, the best practices subgroup. Could we just really be clear about what this, what is the question before the commission right now?
Well, my question was that I thought the business practices subgroup was supposed to be the body that was looking at the technical implementation questions and would look at issues like SCORE. And I think from Commissioner Hall's update, that is something they're looking at. So I just wanted to make sure that if there was a separate group being formed, that they're working in concert with business practices, and that those meetings, like the business practices ones, are noticed and open to the public, and that it's all being done in a consistent fashion, because it doesn't seem like it's a good use of resources to have two groups doing the same work. So making sure that whatever's going on with that separate subgroup, it's either brought into business practices or brought into the commission some way.
Well, I mean, I think if it's a working group within the Secretary of State's office, it's not going to be brought in to the commission. So I don't know what they're working on, but, I mean, we do all kinds of work outside the commission. And if for some business reason the people in elections wanted to get together with some of the technical people in the counties to talk about NCOA, then I'm not going to stop them from doing that.
Follow-up question to that. If it is specifically set up to deal with the NCOA issue, even if it is SCORE, and somewhat seeming like a different level, it really isn't, since it's part of this bill. So I would suggest if it were set up to deal with that, it should be brought into best practices and dealt with how we're dealing with it now instead of a separate entity.
Well, let me just be clear. We will support the commission to the extent that we need to do so under the statute. The commission will not dictate to the Secretary of State's office how we conduct business. So if somebody in the SCORE department is putting together an NCO working group, they will put together an NCO working group, and this commission will not tell the Secretary's office who oversees that group. We're part of the executive branch. There's a legislative branch. We implement, we oversee. That it's not going to happen that way. If they're putting together a working group, they're putting together a working group.
Well, in that case, could we get a briefing from the staff person that's coordinating that so we can understand how it's interplaying with the group that was set up under this commission?
I don't think it's interplaying. So, you know, I mean,
but we don't know what it's doing, so we don't know if it's interplaying or not. And it seems like that would be useful, because if it's top-line practice, that would be useful. If it's, you know, highly technical implementation, that would be useful to know. But my understanding is that there are a lot of decisions and practices that need to be made, and that's something that the commission, at least up until this point, has thought was in its purview to understand what's going on and make recommendations. So if there's a working group working to that end, we should be informed about what they're doing.
Well, I mean, a lot of these departments operate somewhat independently, just like the clerks do. They don't, you know, the clerk's offices don't come and report to me every time they put together a working group. I'm not invited to the clerk's meetings. And if our office wants to have a working group and other clerks want to participate in it, then that's what's going to happen. And I'm not going to ask people in our office to come and inform the commission every time they put together a working group. Representative?
Thank you, Dickie Lee Hollinghorst again. Well, I think the key point here is that if what is happening at the Secretary of State's level on NCOA impacts the implementation of 1303, then there needs to be some involvement on the part of of the of this commission, because that's what the statute says has to happen. So I'm assuming that if there are working groups that are occurring under the Secretary of State that are relate to NCOA or SCORE or other things that might impact the implementation of 1303, that we will be included. That in, if there are other things that need to be worked on, that's fine. But that would be, it seems to me, the assumption that's defined by the statute.
Well, I would have to respectfully disagree. I'm sure there's activities happening over in the legislature right now that have to do with 1303. And I've heard that there's legislation being written right now to define the watcher role and the canvas board role, and that's not coming before the commission. So I don't know why our agency has to bring everything before the commission, but everybody else can operate in secret. So I respectfully disagree that that is under the purview of the bill. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. If I just may answer that for 1 minute. It's a matter of following the statute, and the statute is very clear. I don't have it right in front of me, but this commission was to be involved in the implementation of 1303, and that included all aspects of that implementation. So as far as I know, there's not a law that says that legislators have to share their all that they're doing in preparation for legislation with anybody, and that is also a law. So I think that, I hope we don't have to get to that. What I'm just saying is that I think I'm going to assume that we're okay until we find that there is a big problem relative to this. I think it would be nice if we had good cross communication, but it's absolutely required that if there's something that relates to the implementation of this law, that this commission be involved.
Cindy, you agree?
Thank you. I'm just looking, I think we've had this discussion before on what's the role of the commission. I think it's a little bit unclear because the actual role of the commission says shall evaluate the implementation of Voter Access Modernization Act, shall prepare and present reports, et cetera, et cetera. So logistically, I just am concerned if it's a public meeting, it should be posted somewhere, and then I would assume any commissioner could go attend to any meeting, whether it be at the Capitol or in an outside agency where they feel like they wanted to know what was going on. But from a just operational perspective, I would be a little hesitant to think that we could require the Secretary of State's office to actually bring everything they do before the commission. I don't know that we've been excluded from participating, but I don't want to add another level of compliance that I don't think, quite honestly, we have the authority to do. But if there is information that would be helpful, I'm sure that we'd be able to get at that information or talk to the members of any organization.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Just one quick thing. You're right, we have brought this up in other meetings, and what we've agreed on is that if it impacts any and the ability to implement the law, or if there's any decisions being made, that this commission is tasked with overseeing it. And so when it comes to that kind of thing, I think like what Representative Hollinghorst was saying is that we hope that in good faith we would be made aware of any decisions that actually impact the implementation of the bill so that there isn't a separate isolated body that meets and has actual authority over the changes, especially when the NCOA is concerned, that we are at least made aware of, if not able to make recommendations on. And if that's the case, then I don't think we do have a problem. But if that's not the case and something gets developed outside of this, outside of the awareness of this commission and then is handed down to the clerks, that is something that we've all agreed was our purview as a commission to make sure that that didn't happen and to try and head off any problems before they get to the clerk's level.
But Representative Rankin, I mean, that's why we actually put NCOA on our issue charge so that we could sort of weekly discuss anything going on. But that level of sort of statusing where we are is different from overseeing the details of a working group within Secretary of State. So we should be able to just talk about, yeah, there's a working group, they're off trying to do something. And, you know, if they come up with decisions or make decisions or do something, then that should take 2 minutes in this commission. I mean, it's not something we need to dig into and get a detailed report on, in my view. So it's really a matter of I mean, I agree with everybody. It's it's a matter of statusing and not detail reviewing it that we should think about.
Well, this is Elena. I guess I would disagree somewhat in that I thought that the business practice subgroup was the body that we had decided was the appropriate venue to have those conversations that were technical and make recommendations back. So if there is a need for a separate group from that, that may well be appropriate, but it would be helpful to understand how those two groups are different and distinct and how they're going to work together so that we know how decisions are being made. Because if it's not being done in the group that we established, that may well be fine, but we still need to understand how it all fits together. So if that group's, the business practice group, is coming up with a set of recommendations around NCOA, how do those intersect with this other NCOA group? And is it a clearly defined separation of powers, or are they supporting one another? Or are they coordinating, or are they just on parallel tracks and we'll, you know, duke it out to see which recommendations make sense? And that just seems like a bad use of resources to have it going in the latter rather than the former.
Well, let me just... Fundamentally, the problem is that 1303 is a rewrite of Title I. So when you say oversee the implementation, you're essentially saying this commission oversees the Secretary of State's office. And if that's what you want to do, then I'd suggest you go back to the legislature and you create an election commission and you take those duties out of the Secretary of State's office. Because, no, I am not going to come to this commission, and I'm not going to ask staff to come to this commission every time we make a change. We do many things. This entire recall... we met numerous times amongst ourselves. Did I inform the commission of that? No. Was the commission part of the oversight of that? No. Rulemaking, is that the commission's role? No. That's a separately defined role in statute. I am not going to ask staff to do that. The other thing that this bill says is that we will support the commission within the staffing that we have. We didn't receive an appropriation to do this. And every Monday, I come here for hours, and staff puts in hours of time. And we have so many other things to do right now. We have rulemaking. We have statute rewrites. We have an election coming up. And I am not going to ask everybody on the staff to drop everything Monday afternoon and come report to this commission. It's never going to happen. And if that's the line you all want to draw, then we're going to just take it to the other end of the field. You know, we're not going to come to where you want us to be, where you oversee everything that comes out of this office. We're just going to say, then from now on, we'll just give you some updates on the chart, and that's it. And that's where we're going to be until you pass new legislation, because we are never going to get to where you think we're going to get.
Go ahead. Well, I guess I would disagree that the commission has oversight over all of Title I. I don't think the recalls were particularly relevant. They weren't conducted under 1303. I don't think
1303 says recalls shall be odd by all mail. 1303 certainly mentioned recalls.
If I could finish. I don't think, given the court's ruling, they were conducted under 1303. I don't think that the rules rewrite, even though some of it's related to 1303, a lot of it isn't. But I do think the NCOA practice, which was created in 1303 and was a new policy decision that was made by the legislature as part of House Bill 1303, I think it's hard to argue that the implementation of NCOA is not in this commission's purview. And it may well be that if we talk to the staff, there are totally distinct processes for how the two subgroups are working, and that's fine, and then we can be updated as changes are made. But I'm not sure why we have a subgroup working on policy, which I think we all agreed made a lot of sense, and then not considering that there are other subgroups that may be working at cross purposes. So that doesn't require that they come to every meeting, but I think it would be worth a conversation to understand how they intersect and how they're supposed to work together or work on parallel tracks.
Cindy, agree. It was my understanding that we had several subgroups either that were, you know, approved, so to speak, from this committee or brought in that we heard from earlier on so we could find out what they were doing, how their data and research had provided information that we might be able to use. And I think we're going to continue to draw on some of the expertise from various groups. I think it'd be important to continue to hear from them from time to time. But I also believe this is a prime example of why we need a special session of the legislature to iron out all the problems with this bill. You know, we're rushing this thing through. We can't even agree fundamentally on what role the commission's supposed to play. I think we've brought up numerous areas of law that either we feel are contradictory or need additional explanation or clarification.
I'm concerned that if we wait until, you know, the 2013 election is going to be well before the next session of the legislature, if we wait for the legislature to fix this in the next session, among all the other hundreds of things they're going to have to deal with, this will not get due diligence, and it'll be rushed through again. I think we need to ask the governor to call a special session to iron out some of these issues with this law, and let's continue to work as we have been on trying to get the technical and procedural aspects of logistics together. I'm very concerned at the speed in which we're doing these technological assessments. I think we're overlooking a lot of things. I think we're going to have a lot of problems on the back end and spend a lot of extra money because of it. So I would respectfully request that this commission send a request to the governor to bring the legislature back and let's address some of these issues.
Thank you. This is Dickie Lee Hollinghorst, and I really do have to respectfully disagree with you, Representative Akre. I think this commission has, and I've been sitting on the other side of it for quite a while listening in, I think this commission has done a tremendous amount of work. I think the Secretary of State's office has done a tremendous amount of work. I know that the clerks have made great progress in analyzing just the work that we see that they did today in how 1303 should be implemented. If I were hearing a huge outcry from the county clerks, because I think they're the ones who in the final analysis have to administer these elections and have to administer the statutes and the election law changes on the ground, if I were hearing a huge outcry from them, I might agree with you, but I'm not. I think they're getting their work done. I think the reason that we brought the issue up relative to NCOA is there was some concern that maybe we had two different, probably unintentional, that maybe we had two different groups going off on the same issue, and quite frankly, that doesn't provide the efficiency that we need to get the work done before an election. So I certainly don't think we need a special session. I think we are moving forward to 1303, and the chart that we saw earlier today tends to reinforce that with most of the work done that needs to be done before that election. Quite frankly, I'm having a little hard time figuring out what the great conflict is here. I think that I've heard a request to be involved in a subgroup that may have something to do with NCOA when that relates to 1303, and I think that's perfectly legitimate. And I hope that the Secretary of State's office can do that. If not, then I'm assuming that it really doesn't have a really integral part involved in how we're going to assess NCOA as it implements 1303. And I know that the clerks are going to work very hard on that, and we will be hearing from the Best Practices Committee on that, I'm sure, in the future. So I don't know. I think everything's okay. I don't know that we need to worry too much about it, but I think it's just a heads up that we'd really like to get, you know, really like to have that coordinated if at all possible relative to 1303.
Representative Rankin.
Well, with all due respect, the clerks are not our customers. The citizens of Colorado are our customers, and we have an obligation here to oversee the implementation of a law that's on the books. And, you know, I've struggled with what the role of this commission is, and I think that's at the heart of this discussion we're having now. I mean, what control or power do we really have? I personally have kind of taken the position that we're like a big project manager. You know, we're supposed to track the schedule and the things that might go wrong and point those out to people. And, you know, if we get overwhelmed by one, then we go back for legislation, or we've even talked about a referred measure to change the Constitution to align it with 1303. We've talked about all those future things we need to do. So, I mean, I think a fundamental discussion is what is this commission all about? But, man, I do not think we're here to satisfy the clerks. I, Representative, I apologize for disagreeing on that.
Sorry, you're
second. I know it might interfere with your retort, but Cindy Acree was actually next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I agree with you, most everything that you said. However, I do believe that the county clerks are the experts here. They're actually in the trenches. But we're a state that has a state statute governing 64 counties that we're trying to address issues that impact access to your right to vote all across the state in a system that typically has been less than uniform. And I believe that the cost associated in the implementation of this bill with all the counties is going to be an issue. And we haven't actually heard from the county clerks to address some of the questions that have been left unanswered. So I certainly would like to hear from them and have some of the questions that I have, and I know some of my colleagues have, in regards to technology or implementation strategies or costs and funding that, you know, would make sense for us to get at. But I certainly don't think that this commission has the authority to overreach what's going on in the Secretary of State's office as to the implementation of this bill. I think we could agree on a lot more if we had more clarification in the statute and we addressed some of these issues through the legislature, and the legislature is the place to do this. This commission cannot make policy. We can only make recommendations in that regard.
Representative.
Thank you. Dickie Lee Hollinghorst again, and thank you, Representative Acree and Representative Rankin. I appreciate what you said, and I agree. I think this one of the roles of this commission is to be a project manager. And as you know, a project manager has to keep track of all of the elements of what we're doing, which is implementing a specific project, which is implementation of 1303. And I think that was why we came up with the discussion on NCOA. There may be some things there that need to be addressed that we may not be aware of. And when that happens, if there is a separate group working on that, we're hoping that that will come through the business practices group, because I believe that's what was set up to deal with those kinds of issues. And as I remember, this commission came to agreement. I seem to remember listening in or sitting in on a meeting of this commission previously that did, in fact, agree that our job was to oversee in specific. And I think everybody agreed, because that's how this all happens, in specific, the implementation of 1303. That was how the statute was interpreted, and it doesn't take much interpretation if you look at the language. So that's point number one. Point number two is that one of the people that I listen to, and I think a very important group to listen to as to how this is all going, are the county clerks all over the state. We have representatives on this commission from rural and urban, and we hear through the various committees how this is all going, and they seem to be, you know, moving along pretty well and fairly happy with how this is all going. And if I hear differently, or if I hear differently from my constituents, which are, I agree, our most important responsibility, I certainly want to take that into account, but I would want to bring it back to this commission. And quite frankly, if there are things in the statute that aren't clear, we're probably going to get to a discussion of that. But right now, we're really busy with those things that are clear that we have to do to implement this law. And I think there's pretty general agreement on that. So I'm happy to have a discussion about things that we should do to clarify the statute. When, you know, and I took note of your issue. You know, maybe there's a way to address that if we think it's unclear. But there are other things that we really need to concentrate on. And so I'm going to stop talking. Thank you.
Go ahead, Jess.
Thanks. And actually, to the NCOA question, were we not supposed to have an update or a status, some information about how things are currently going, moving forward?
Or no? I just don't think we have that staff here today. So, I mean, that's just one of our ongoing problems in trying to staff this kind of commission. I don't think Trevor knows. So,
back to a previous point that I made is that the best practices commission?
Business practice subgroup,
sorry. One thing that we did decide earlier on is that in order to avoid any kind of program implementation without the input of that body was so that that body did hear in front of them any discussions that have to do with the implementation of 1303, including but not limited to NCOA. And so pertaining to this discussion, I do want some kind of verbal confirmation that there won't be any major policy changes or requirements of the counties or anything handed down to them, because we've made that decision prior to today that we would at least intercede in that space, at least weigh the issues in front of us when something was kind of being handed down either by the Secretary of State to the clerks or vice versa, or whenever it came to someone being told that this was a change or that this was somehow changing how they would do their business currently. I do kind of want some verbal confirmation that when it comes to NCOA changes, that whatever sub-working group inside the Secretary of State's office just isn't making decisions in an isolated way about that issue in particular that will then impact the clerk's ability to implement it if they haven't had a chance to at least weigh in or understand what those changes will be.
Well, if it wasn't apparent from the fact that I didn't even know there was a working group, it should be apparent that I wouldn't know what's being handed down to the counties. I mean, we have different divisions that operate in different ways, and I don't get updates on everything. I mean, I have a separate job aside from that. You would have to get a commitment from, you know, every manager in the elections department that they weren't handing down things to the clerks, and that's just not going to happen. I don't meet with them weekly to find out what's going down to the clerk. I don't even get a copy of the week in brief. So,
but again, I'm
not
saying
the person.
Everything. I'm just saying when it comes to this issue of the NCOA as it applies to 1303 implementation, it seems fairly simple.
I guess I'm not understanding the just focus on NCOA. Why is there such a – I mean, we've heard about NCOA. It seems in a disproportionate amount to the issues in this bill. I'm not getting the
– I think it's because today, because it is part of what we're tasked with. It was specifically part of 1303. It is new, and it was brought up today that there may be a separate group based at the Secretary of State making decisions about that. So it very directly pertains to what we're doing here today.
But so does everything that we do. So I don't – I guess I just don't know why I would go out of my way to isolate NCOA and make sure that this commission knew everything that was going on with NCOA.
So when
there's
my understanding, it was already being isolated, and that's what we were addressing, is that there, it was brought up today that there may be a separate group that was working just on that within your office, separate from the best practices.
But why would I isolate that issue among 100 other issues to make sure that we don't give something to the clerks that the commission hasn't seen when there are 99 other issues out there that we're not hearing about? I'm just not understanding what it is about NCOA.
So there isn't a group that meets separately to govern this?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay.
I mean, Amber seemed to know maybe there was talk of one, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, all she knows is talk of one, so...
Right, and that's why I brought it up. I was on the business practice call where that update was given, and so I wanted to learn more. To be clear, of the 100 issues, I would say the vast majority, to the extent they relate to 1303, are on my list for tracking, and I think that's true of many of the commissioners, all of us. We may have different ones. I think the reason NCOA has been a point of interest is that there have been issues and disagreements. And my understanding is that there are still practices being developed to figure out how to implement it properly. And so to the extent that that's still happening and it's not happening as part of one of the standing groups, there's interest in learning how that's going. Well, whereas the voter service and polling center practices, that's happening through the business practice subgroup. So we all, I think, have a good sense of how that piece is going. The changes on registration forms, you know, we've seen them. So I think there are a lot of issues of interest. That's just one where we haven't quite resolved some of the questions and concerns around it.
Well, it sounds like if there is one, the clerks have been invited to it, and there'll be some overlap with the other group. So I guess I don't see the issue. Yeah, I mean, Denver's saying they were invited to it. They're also a member of the other subgroup. So there would be some natural overlap on the group. And I would imagine they would work it out amongst themselves. I just don't see where the commission's role is to determine that. So if I mean, I'll find out what the group is, and we can talk about it next time, but I'm not making any commitments about what they do or don't do because I have no idea.
Thank you. It'd be good to hear what they're doing. Thanks.
This is Hillary. I apologize. I have to go and talk with an insurance adjuster, so I'm going to have to jump off, and Fran will keep me informed what else you all need from me. And then it sounds like, yeah, maybe clarifying exactly what we want from the business practice group as an agenda item for next time would be great, especially with the first study that we had done that talked about the importance of mapping out business processes, you know, collectively, not, you know, either, you know, collectively, and then aligning technology to it. Seems like it's an ongoing conversation that would be really useful. So, and I apologize to say that and have to leave. I will follow up after the meeting. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. All right. The next item on the agenda is the mock. And again, we don't have anyone to present this item, but we did ask them to put together some materials for the commission regarding the mock election. And so within your packets, you have the counties that participated and a short report on some of the issues that came up during the mock election and perhaps changes that we intend to implement before November. Does anybody have any questions about the documents we submitted? Representative Rankin?
I would be concerned. How can we translate this material to outstanding issues that we need to track and close on? I'm looking at challenges here. Are those open issues? What are they?
Well, they are open issues for us to take back and try to develop new processes. For instance, the ballot on demand, there was quite a bit about the ballot on demand and its use, and one of the issues we're having with that has to do with support that we're providing to the counties. So that's an internal issue that we need to be providing more support up front. I don't think there were any programming issues, were there, Trevor? No, there were no programming issues. One of them, you know, we looked really closely because of our issues with Citrix, and Trevor talked about that earlier. But we didn't have any issues with SCORE, with the database. The one I mostly heard about was the BOD use, the ballot on demand.
Are they mostly process, business process issues?
Yeah, they are. They're business process and support issues. So more technical than business process. You, there were issues with the ballot on demand that related to it being used in an early voting model. Now that there's no early voting, general support from the vendor and from our office when questions came up, and its usability and functionality.
I guess what I'm asking is, how do we deal with this data? What do we do with it? I mean, I can't even understand half of it.
Judd, what are we going to do with the data from the mock election? All right. Wait for the mic.
Fantastic. A mere button. Each year after the mock election, we take the information from the data that we receive, and we identify counties that we feel like need some assistance or initiatives where a number of counties struggled. And then we plan out how to address those particular deficiencies and figure out a plan for whatever the next major election hurdle is. On the ballot on demand issue, so each county got a ballot on demand printer from our office in 2012. Some counties use that in quite extensively. Some counties used it a little bit, and many counties didn't use it at all. It was probably more a function of the timing in the election cycle. This particular, now that we've gotten into 2013, we're hoping that the counties will use the ballot on demand printers more extensively and more in sort of coordination with the requirements of the VSPCs. And what ended up happening was that we tried to set up the mock election so that they would do that. But one of the things that they needed to have was the files to input into the system to be able to run it and practice on it. And the vendor struggled to get those files to the participating counties on time. So we had some counties that were able to use it because they had previous experience using it and they didn't really need a file to be able to run it. And then we had a number of counties that were in the posture of having never used it and needed to be able to get the basics to be able to get into the process of using it, and the vendor wasn't able to come through. So that kind of left us back to where we were prior to the election, which is that we really need to be able to create the infrastructure within our office to be able to help the counties through that kind of hurdle. That's one of the reasons why the UVS process makes a lot of sense, because then we can have the expertise in office to do it. Trevor's also got some people on his staff who have been trained up on it now that we couldn't do prior to 2012. So we're in a posture now where we can begin to really help counties. In fact, we just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, held a training session here at our office with a number of local counties. We are also going out to regional meetings around the state to give training to those counties that are not in a position to know how the BOD works. So, yes, sir.
Well, that's an interesting discussion, because ballot on demand will be used a good bit more with voting centers than it was previously, will it not? Because people show up and need a ballot that's, the ballot style is different from the place where they're voting, so there'll be more demand. So my point is, this is a 1303 implementation issue or not? We've been talking about...
I wouldn't think so. I mean, we've had ballot on demand for half a dozen years. I've been in counties for as long as I've been associated with elections in the state.
So 1303 did not cause this problem to change?
No. Ballot on demand printers could be used in any election setting.
Right.
So if we were in polling places,
right,
and we still, like in the past, in this recall election, ballot on demand was used in both counties for the recall election, and that was not a vote center model. It kind of was used like a vote center model because it was one jurisdiction in each county, but that's not the way that it necessarily had to work. There are also a number of counties that have never done a vote center election, which have ballot on demand and have been using it for a long time. It does work particularly well in a vote center model, because you might have people coming in from various parts of your county and they need a ballot, and you can just go issue them one off the ballot on demand printer. The problem with that, though, is that if you're in a big enough county and you're trying to use a ballot on demand printer at each one of your locations, you are depending heavily on one sort of piece of equipment, and it's probably going to get a lot of use over... You've got multiple lines of people checking in. You've got multiple lines of people being issued ballots. And you've got to be able to issue them the exact right ballots at all the right times. Generally speaking, counties don't like to do that. What they like to do is get ahead and buy and produce bulk that they can then distribute by hand. So it's not – ballot on demand is this great way to supplement your already existing ballot or election structure. I'm glad I walked in at that very moment. But, so.
Yeah.
What I was trying to get at here is, what can we pull out of the mock elections that might be issues that would prevent the successful implementation of 1303? I mean, that's simple. I mean,
there was.
Are these just things that you'd be doing anyway?
Yeah, but, these are all things that we would be doing anyway. We did these after the 2011 mock election. 2012 didn't have a mock election because we actually had two real ones, so no time for a mock one. But the 2011 produced a list just like that. We implemented a bunch of sort of solves to try to overcome any failures that we saw in the mock election. Generally speaking, what the mock election is, and for the county people in the room, they'll all know what I'm talking about, it's like a refresher course. It's, you have a run election in 9 months, here's what you do, remember you do this, and oh, right, yeah, that's how I do that. And it's just a process of trying to rediscover how you use that muscle that you haven't thought about in a long time, and hopefully get you thinking about those kinds of things that you need to get implemented on a policy side or employee side or training side in the 6 or 8 or 10 months leading to the next election.
Were there things that will be required in November under 1303 that we were not able to simulate or practice in the mock election?
Not that occur to me. But there may be. I mean, there may be details that we were still in development on. But nothing occurs to me right now. Okay. Thanks.
All right. I have one question. Oh. Is the ballot demand system part of the LAT process?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Is the ballot on demand part of the logic and accuracy testing process?
It has not been part of the logic and accuracy testing process. I'm not sure that we're prepared to go there yet. It could be that we would need to fold that into the testing regime, but at this point it's not.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, the only other item left on the agenda is just planning the next agenda items. Oh, also we have the checklist. Your checklist, do you want to do that today? Representative Rankin, yeah. Oh, you wanted to add that. Yeah, recall cleanup. Recall cleanup statutes. Well, one thing that I think we need to do within the cleanup is some kind of section that changes the recall statutes. And what we've talked about internally is to match the Constitution and then have that go into effect, but perhaps repealed if a constitutional question was referred and passed. But one way or another, we need to get those back into being in sync. So we either need to take recalls out of mail ballot or we need to get the timelines out of the Constitution. Go ahead.
I guess I could defer to the folks that are in the legislature, but are you suggesting that we're entertaining before this commission the idea of recommendations on policy regarding recalls?
Well, it's a policy regarding 1303. That 1303 said recalls would be conducted by all mail, and now they can't be. Go ahead, Representative.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I guess that's an interesting way of looking at it. The issue that comes from that we've ran into relative to the recall is a result of a statute that was passed, I think, I don't remember, 2006, 2007. That changed the timelines. I would think that the most important thing to do, since recall elections are part of general, would have to be a part of the county clerk's processes, at least at the state level, state election level, that we look at, that somebody look at changing the statute if possible, and sometimes it might be constitutional as well, but if there is a possibility to change the statute so those differences in timelines can be adjusted, then I don't see that as a 1303 issue. That wasn't an issue that 1303 created. It was the difference in timelines relative to when you file for an election and when you have to do a recall election, and that's all been in the statute. I would think that's where people would want to go first, and I think there is some looking at that, but I don't believe that that is a commission issue. Now, if there was some thought that somehow you would change the statute that 1303 created that said you would do a recall election differently. You would have to do a recall election differently than you do any other election, then that might be a problem, an other election that's held by the state and the county. Then maybe we should address that through this commission, but I don't see that as implementing 1303. So I think we need to have some folks take a look at how that statute may be changed so that it can't, so that recalls can be a part of what 1303 required.
Richard?
I think I understand the issue, and I'm going to articulate it in my own words, and please correct me, but I think the 1303 issue is the fact that it's supposed to be a mail ballot. And you can't, and trying to do a mail ballot election with a constitutional deadline of 15 days for designating the candidate is what creates the conflict. And so the 1303 issue from an implementation standpoint is 1303 said it'll be a mail ballot. And to do a mail ballot with the deadline up to 15 days before the election being, you know, you putting on new candidates, that's, it's my understanding, it's virtually impossible as it manifested in this particular, these two recall elections.
Well, and there was a change in 1303. Prior to 1303, recalls were not done by all mail. And in 1303, it said recalls will be done in accordance with this section, which is all mail. So it wasn't something done back in 2006. It was something done last year. And I mean, if we want to leave it as is, that's fine, but we're going to end up in the same place we were last time over and over again with, you know, this back and forth on rulemaking, because there is no way under the court's ruling to harmonize. There is no mechanism to hold an election anymore with a 15-day deadline. There's nothing in the statutes that gives us anything to do with that. Representative Rankin?
Well, yeah, it's explicit in 1303. I mean, it explicitly changed it. So, and from the first, we've always said that one role of this commission is to identify and recommend those things in legislation or constitutional change that were required to implement 1303. I mean, this is one of them, very clearly. I think there'll be others. So, yeah, I think that's, I struggle with what the role of this commission is, but it's very clear to me that recommendations for new legislation to clarify or correct or whatever 1303 are part of it. So, and as a legislature who'll be going back and talking about this along with you, Representative, I want us to be very clear about what's required.
Oh, sorry, Elena.
Well, I think part of the reason it's complicated is I think even absent 1303, there would have been a significant conflict because of the heavy use of mail ballots and the use of no-fault absentee. So we would have seen very similar problems. There just would have also been the in-person structure. So I think in some ways it is distinct from 1303 in that really it's creating a voting model that is completely distinct from how we've run elections for the last 20 years. Now, it's certainly related to 1303 and something that we could take on, but it's also a much larger issue, so it may be one where we want to bring in other stakeholders and invite other comment, because we are really talking about creating a voting system that's very different from how we've run elections in modern times in Colorado.
Representative?
Yeah, I think, thank you. This is Dickie Lee Hollinghorst. I think that's the point, Representative Rankin, is that there's another place in statute that's created significant issues for recall elections relative to how you file candidacies. And I think all of those things should be addressed at once. And then if indeed we decide that this is a 1303 issue, then I absolutely agree with you. I think this commission should take a look at it. But I also agree that maybe that's something that a separate subcommittee could be involved in trying to look at all of the various, what could possibly be a solution to this so that recall elections can be held as closely as possible to the way you hold other elections would be very important.
But it's worse than that, because it's not statute, it's constitution. It's
agree.
A constitutional issue on qualifying and getting signatures. So we can't just go back on statute and change the qualification timeline. So you know, it becomes a very complicated issue because it's a conflict between 1303 and statute, which evidently the writers of 1303 did not realize at the time or anticipate a recall. But wait a minute, I think it was underway at the time, but never, you know, nevertheless.
But Representative?
I would actually just say that there's not agreement on what you just said, that 1303 caused those problems or the change statute that necessarily caused the deadlines and et cetera to not accommodate a mail election. That's why I would say until there's some kind of a, as Representative Hollinghorst said, yes, there's problems with the recall, and it is, and there are constitutional issues and statutory issues, but that it isn't under the purview of 1303. So that I would say until there's agreement that there's an objective of this commission as it pertains to 1303 specifically and only to the bill, we can't say that we can fix the recall problem here.
Okay. I guess that just leaves the next agenda. Do we want to just have that on October 7th when we go to Denver? Or you want to have a meeting before then? Representative?
Thank you. Dickie Lee Hollinghorst, in terms of putting the recall issue on the agenda, I think it would be good to have some folks do some research for us on what the specific issues are, where in the statutes they occur, when they occurred, and what's constitutional and what is possibly solved through statutory change. And I think that might help us, although I'm not sure, you know, I think that there are other stakeholders involved in that, and so I think it would be important to have, you know, perhaps a committee or the Secretary of State work with folks to make that a recommendation to this group if, in fact, 1303 needs to be involved. I'm very willing to listen to that, but I think that that's an open question at the moment. I'd like to see the research on it.
Cindy?
Could we have Ledge Council just give us a summary of where in statute or the Constitution these conflicts lie so we know what we're dealing with?
I don't have any authority over Ledge Council.
We've got two legislators here that do.
So do you. But, yeah, we could, you know, I don't know that it's exactly the our responsibility to do that, but I'd be happy to, you know, make an inquiry. We could ask for some information, but I think we need to have some more specific information about.
I can do it as a commission member.
I join you with that. Yeah, you're the commission member, and I'm sort of don't know what I am.
And I just want to be clear, that's actually more what I was trying to articulate, so thank you, Representative, is that, and I would like to see all of that, where in statute, where in the Constitution, and then we can be very clear where it pertains to this group.
Good point.
So we're talking about the recall now?
Yes.
Conflict, yeah.
The recall issue, yeah.
I can give it to you. Section 82 of the bill, I've got it in front of me. It says for all general, primary, odd year, coordinated recall, that was added. And then it's the conflict between that and Article 21 of the Constitution. That says 15 days.
Yeah.
However, there are other issues, and I understand what you're saying there, but I would like to have some experts take a look at where we can change the statute, and that isn't a 1303 issue necessarily, and where we can't, and where there are constitutional issues, and we may even want to look at that. So I think it's not just cut and dried. I think you need to take a look at all of the issues relative to candidate filings, timelines relative to recall, how that relates to mail ballot issues, and I'd like to see the full range of issues involved in that before we take it on totally.
Other than just this one issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in addition to that issue, clearly. Yeah.
Okay. I think that takes us to oh, right.
This goes back to Mr. Branscombe's comments. It's the item of
November 2013 issues. It's, you know, as we go through that, preparation for it and the conduct of the election, we always have talked about capturing, you know, any problems that we have and using those on our checklist. And I believe Mr. Branscombe talked about a checklist, and that was with the EAC checklist, the survey that we can give the clerks in advance and have them collect information as they go through the November 2013. So I'd like to propose to the commission that we use that survey. We're going to look at it first, but you know, we use some kind of a survey to give the clerks in advance so that we can capture the experience of the 2013 election. Is that okay?
That's fine.
All right.
That's a good idea.
Will you work with me on that?
Okay. Yeah, I would just like to see the survey before we decide that it's appropriate. I mean, because we may have to modify it, but yeah, we can just.
I don't even know what it is, but it's an EAC survey. And maybe next week we can use that as an item.
Steve, can you see if you can get that from his email? Did you send that already? No. Okay.
Right. You can.
Okay.
But you'll help us with that.
Okay.
Good.
Steve, if you can pull the EAC survey, we'll put that on for next time. Any other agenda items?
Well, going back to public comments again, I guess, was it Marilyn Marks requested that we capture cost experience from the two counties that did the recall? Do you have an interest in doing that?
I don't have any authority to get them.
Possible.
I mean,
I don't know that it's, given that it wasn't run under 1303, it was sort of a hybrid court ordered, you know, last minute attempt to make sure everyone can vote. I don't know that it would be that helpful. I think it would be helpful to look at 2013, and once we've had the coordinated, that might be a place where we could study, but I think the recalls were just so unique.
Okay.
Any others? Agenda items?
I think the other issue, and I think this comes out of business practice, and I don't know if we'll be ready to talk about it next week or at a future meeting, the whole issue of training. Hillary mentioned that the training manuals are being developed and they were going to share them with us, but it seems like it'd be helpful to have the subgroup report back and also talk about how in some places it varies from county to county, but what's in place for November.
We do have those.
Cindy Acree, and in light of the training issue, I still think that we need to look at the legislature to expand the time frame upon which we can, you know, train our election judges, because I know that every county does it differently, and I hate limiting it to 45 days prior, especially in a year or 2 years where it's going to be a brand new system. I think we need some latitude on that.
Definitely agree.
And just to clarify, you mean the timeline when they can start training election judges? That one's?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So I have four agenda items for next week so far. Discussion of the scope of the business practice subgroup, recall statute cleanup discussion, EAC survey, and training. Does that cover everything?
Yeah. Anyone have anything else?
No? I want to go back to recalls for just
I'm not sure we have time.
That whole issue of people. That whole issue of people changing their dress at the last minute, do we have or can we get any numbers and compare those to other elections? I mean, I'm just trying to ascertain whether or not we really have a problem. Did people go there from other areas and try to state their intent to live in other counties? And
well, I have total numbers I can give you. I don't know what they were last year or...
Excuse me.
I mean, it's hard to go back and look because the numbers I pulled were numbers from 29 days. So I looked at how many people moved from somewhere else in Colorado and how many new registrations we had in the last 29 days to see what the impact was of 1303. So I don't know if that's comparable to how many people switched in prior years, because those switches would have been made before the cutoff for registration.
Do we know how many same-day registrations used to change of address?
I'd have to go back and pull the actual dates to see if they were same-day or not. I know that new registrants in SD 11 were 1420, people who had moved from somewhere else in Colorado into SD 20 in the last 28 days were 525. SD 3 new registrations in the last 29 days were 379. And people moving from one district in Colorado to another in SD 3 during those days was 231. So I have total numbers, but I don't know how that would match up since we've never done it. I don't know. I mean, it's not a lot compared to, you know, certainly what we saw moving up to the 2012 presidential. We saw huge registration numbers in the last few days. So I don't know whether that's a lot or a little. I don't know what to compare it to. Jesse?
Just real quick, we're up against the 4 o'clock deadline, and some of the numbers that you want, I'm not even certain that the results have been certified. And even though people are moving around, that doesn't necessarily reflect who may have voted. And so instead of kind of getting into that sort of discussion last minute or flippantly, maybe we put it off to another time, because it seems like those are numbers we don't want to just toss around. And I think what you were asking is if voters broke the law, if there was criminal activity when people went and voted and falsified their, you know, their paperwork, which, again, we don't really know, but we know one case.
I mean, they're just numbers. I don't know what they tell you.
It's a huge public perception problem, though. Again, if we can say that we don't have a problem, that would be good.
Well, that's why we're looking at them, not necessarily that we're going to act on them, but that we want to know, and then I want to, you know, see how many of those voted and how many then changed their address back before November, I guess. Right.
Well, or listening to what Amber put in front of us today, I mean, how many multiple sets of barriers does a voter come across before they can actually do with that, what we've been describing as that inaccurate public perception of any kind of activity like that? I mean, it's a lot. Plus, again, the criminal act. So, I think it's something we can take up in the future, is to help, you know, disseminate that inaccurate perception.
I would just offer one more, Madam Chairman. I just like to offer one comment on that. And that is, in the packet that we all have in front of us, in the comments that were provided by Marilyn Marks, she cites the one provision, the one change to, and it's Section 7 of the statute, where a provision that was specifically articulated before the 1303 amendment as being a manner in which you lost your residency, it was turned into it's quoted in the Gazette Telegraph piece. It specifically turned the entire intent of that provision around, and it says, if a person moves from one county or precinct in the state to another with the intention of making the new county or precinct to permanent residence, the person is considered to have residency in the county or precinct to which the person moved. I've done enough criminal law when I was in the AG's office for 4.5 years that section alone would be a safe harbor, so long as the person, even if the paperwork is, quote, false, as long as the issue is, did you have an intention to be a resident, that language is a safe harbor in the statute to protect that person, and no DA can prosecute it. So I would just, you know, to bring this point home and clarify it, that's the language. A statute that was previously did A is turned into B, which made it an affirmative self-protection of moving into a new district.
Representative.
Thank you. Well, if we're going to start talking constitutional law, I think maybe we should get some advice from a whole variety of lawyers on this. But I will tell you that intention to make a place your permanent voting residence for intention to vote has been in the statute for many, many, many years. 1303 did not change that. Now, there may be some language involved in 1303 that clarifies, voting relative to registration, but there is nothing in 1303 that changed that very important precept in Colorado election law, which is that you define, and there are some things that are listed in rules, current rules and current statute, that define that intention to make something your permanent voting residence. 1303 did not change that either. So if you want to challenge that precept, then we have to talk about new legislation that does not relate to 1303, in my opinion.
All right, any other items on the agenda? What meeting date? You want to do 2 weeks? You want to do next week? You want to do the 7th? Anyone have a preference? I mean, now that the report's done, I guess that's something we can discuss. I'd prefer not to continue to meet every week, but.
No. Agree.
All right. So what's the date? It's the 16th. So when would that put us to the 29th or something?
So if we meet in 2 weeks, that would be the 30th.
Okay. All right. Should we do that, and then we'll do the field trip the next week? Okay, sounds good. 30th. All right, then we're adjourned.